Supposed to be queued up.
Okay, we're gonna the committee to order. Some technology matters to tend to. You want to go? We good? All right, this is the Monday, February 25th, 2013 committee meeting of the Transportation and Public Safety Committee. Members, just for your information, we are on television today. We have two matters in front of the committee. First, we're just going to have a presentation from Senator Roger Reinert of Duluth, assisted by Dwayne Hill, who's the district engineer for MnDOT District 1, to learn a little bit more about the flooding that occurred in Duluth last summer and the impact on our infrastructure, particularly our transportation infrastructure, and a little bit about how our state and our agency was able to respond to and address what was a pretty dramatic situation up in Duluth last summer. With that, welcome to the committee. Welcome to your committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Reinert, and thank you so much for putting this together for us, and proceed as you will.
You're welcome. Thank you, Chair Dibble, members of the Transportation Committee. Appreciate the opportunity to talk about what was a pretty dramatic experience for those of us in the Northland last summer. Mr. Chair, what I thought I would do is, I know not all of us were here last summer and took part in the special session. So members, I've got a couple short clips that I did during the storm, and I fed those out kind of real time to everyone so they could see what we were going through up north. And I'll show those just to give you a little bit of context, and then ask Mr. Hill, our District 1 engineer, to speak more specifically about the transportation issues. And Mr. Chair, I think we did focus on the transportation infrastructure. I know there are both city and county representatives here if we want to go further afield, but that was not our intent in giving you this overview. So with your permission to start, members, this was the day of the flood. So this video, it's 45 seconds long, shot right in the heart of downtown Duluth. About most of you know where Canal Park is. This is about five blocks up the hill from Canal Park. What you're going to see is First Avenue West, City Street. And what had happened is over the course of, and what you have to keep in mind is this wasn't just this storm. We had had some 8 inches of rain in the previous 11 days. And then we had this deluge that started the evening before, rained all night long, and pretty much all of the next day. And in this case, part of the stormwater system overflowed up at the top of this hill, and by the time that day was done, we had a little Old Faithful shooting water down this street, and it really became a raging river throwing rocks and stone and everything in its way. And the red car that you see midway up, fortunately, we were able to get everything. I've got a friend who owns a building there, so I got a call in the morning. My building is flooding. You know, he's calling all his friends. So we came over, and we were helping. We got all the tenants' cars moved, but this red one halfway up had so much debris shoved under it by moving water that that car didn't get saved. It was a total loss from flooding. Apologize for not the best sound quality, but that's, you get the idea of being right on the spot. A couple days later, We were able to go up the St. Louis River to the Fond du Lac neighborhood, which is our neighborhood closest to the river, closest to the water, by far sustained the most damage, the most long-term damage, where we had the most homes flooded and that sort of thing. So this, again, is just under a minute, and it's from a trip up the river with our water rescue, our St. Louis County rescue squad.
Most of them still are back in their homes. We're still just trying to clear things away to try and get basic utility and road infrastructure established. Still have a lot of homes that have water in the homes, in the yards. So, while again, it was open for business and much of the city is in good shape, we still have, especially this western part, down by J. Cook State Park, by the city of Thompson and Carlton, that are still really severely impacted and are going to take a long time to recover. So thank you for continuing to keep us in thoughts and prayers and sending us your muscles and your donations, and I'll update you again sometime soon.
So, Mr. Chair, just a little bit of context from last summer, and it's always surprising how quickly we move on. There are many issues facing the state of Minnesota, unless, of course, you lived through it. And before I turn it over to Mr. Hill, I would just say a couple of things. Number one, I couldn't have been prouder of this body than the way everyone came together, not only in an official way. The special session was less than 2 months later and provided a lot of much-needed help, but to all of you as members who took the time to call or text or shoot me an email and say, hey, what can I do? We're thinking of you. I mean, it's just, you know, we're all here for months at a time, and, you know, sometimes we're friends and sometimes we're opponents, but when push came to shove, you know, Senator Senjum and Speaker Zellers were there within a week, and it showed Minnesotans that when it really, really matters, we're all on the same team, and I thought that was it was very much appreciated, and I thought it was a good message for everyone. And before I turn it over to Mr. Hill, I just want to say how appreciative I am of the work that MnDOT did. Up and down, folks got on it. There were plenty of opportunities for people to say, you know, that rule or this regulation or this schedule for that project isn't going to work, and that's not at all what was said. Instead, it was what do we need to do, and how can we use some of these things to, you know, maybe we'll move a project forward. It was a lot of, I think our public employees too often get kind of critiqued for being inside the machine, and this wasn't the case. I thought time and again they were innovative and creative and figured out how to make it happen, and as a result, the recovery has gone quite well. So, Mr. Chair, I'll introduce Dwayne Hill, our District 1 engineer, Minnesota Department of Transportation.
Great. Thanks. And Senator Reinert, and I think you mentioned in that last video that it was much more widespread than Duluth. I don't know if a lot of folks in Minnesota really appreciate that the whole St. Louis River Valley and all the way down to Moose Lake, there's a lot of impact that was pretty widespread. Your audition tape for CNN is quite impressive. Look out, Anderson Cooper.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate you mentioning that. I sometimes can be a bit Duluth-centric, but in fact, probably some of the hardest hit areas were Thompson and Carlton and areas just south of Duluth. You know, small communities. Thompson's a great example. The main street damaged in Thompson was a several million dollar project, and this is a town of, you know, less than a thousand people. So it was widespread. Moose Lake and Senator Laurie's district was especially hard hit in terms of home flooding and things like that. So it really, really was a northeastern Minnesota disaster.
Yeah, thank you. Welcome, Mr. Hill.
Right. Good afternoon, Chairman and committee members. I'll try to give you a brief overview of what we experienced during this flood. So what I thought I'd do is just try to describe the major impacts of the event and what our agency's response was, the MnDOT response, and then some of the observations I had about local response, and then also the work that's been completed and what's remaining to be completed. So on this slide here, you can see a couple of things. On the right is a picture of northeastern Minnesota. It describes our district, District 1. And on the left, the hydrograph describes where the flood event happened. And we had impacts on our trunk highway system from just south of Grand Rapids all the way down I-35 south of Moose Lake towards the Sandstone area, and also all the way west to Aiken County. So the McGregor area, Big Sandy, there was a lot of especially residential flooding out in that part of the state. And then also up the shore, there's one little dot on that map where there was a real intense rainfall kind of centered right around just north of Two Harbors. And I was reminded that they got 11 inches of rain just north of Two Harbors, and it happened twice in a period of 3 weeks in that particular area. Just kind of the biggest blotch on that map is the St. Louis River Valley. And from the colors on the hydrograph, it's somewhere between 8 and 10 inches of rainfall from this one event. And that's really a significant thing when it falls all the way through entirely within that river valley. This is a really good photograph. I hope you can see it, at least on the handouts, of Lake Superior from a satellite view. And the brown in Lake Superior kind of helps show, you know, what happened to St. Louis County and where a lot of the sediment ended up. In Lake Superior, in the Duluth Harbor, and every stream channel changed its course during that event and had significant impacts to the environment. Our initial response was to work with the law enforcement agencies to close the roads that were necessary. When every road is flooded, what we found out is we don't have enough people or equipment in one region of the state to address the problems. We had to ask for help from MnDOT districts around our surrounding area to bring equipment and people in to help man barricades and set up barricades and make sure the roads were closed and safe. We used the incident command structure within our district, and we also worked very closely with St. Louis County and the city of Duluth on their incident command structure. We had regular meetings every day to update each agency on what the status of our roads were and the progress of our repairs. And at one time, we had 26 closures on the trunk highway system. And there were upwards of 100 closures on the local highway system during the same period of time. I mentioned we used resources from within our agency. We had employees come from the Brainerd area, the Bemidji area, and from St. Paul to help man barricades the first couple of days of the flood because we needed to have a 24/7 presence. We also had people bringing equipment from all around the state, which was really important to recognize that we were able to mobilize barricades, signing, barrels, even heavy equipment like excavators to help remove debris and rebuild the roads as quickly as possible. We had excellent cooperation with Department of Public Safety and DNR through this process in dealing with permitting discussions on issues with streams and cooperation with public safety on our road closures and very close communication on making sure that we kept the public safe during this event.
And, Mr. Chairman, I would just add, even snow plows and graders were engaged as we tried to clear mud away from Highway 23 in Fond du Lac. Just that flotsam and the damage down on that end of town was remarkable. And as Dwayne indicated, it was just everything being washed downstream from the entire river valley being flooded.
How does the equipment hold up when it's pushing that kind of stuff?
The snowplows are very well suited for moving woody debris. Even when we have a windstorm, that's one of the first things our maintenance people may do is put a snowplow on the front of their dump trucks because it'll help push those trees back after we cut them, and it saves a lot on the back labor and reduces our chance of getting hurt. Another thing I want to mention is we brought FHWA in to the Duluth area like 2 days after the event. They did training for all the local agencies on the Federal Highway Administration emergency relief process, and made sure that everybody was clear on how to document the damage so that we could maximize our opportunities for reimbursement from both FHWA and FEMA. MnDOT received emergency contracting authority, and we use that to hire consultants to help do design work and contractors to help with our immediate needs. And it was very, very necessary to bring in those private entities to help with this recovery. And the last thing I want to mention is we were also able to assist the city of Duluth through a mutual aid process. And in the Fond du Lac neighborhood that Roger mentioned, we helped remove debris from city streets and really made a big impact on the local community by making sure that the people felt comfortable cleaning out their homes and getting back on with their lives after this event subsided. With our own forces, we focused on reopening the roads and making them safe for travel. We set and removed road closure signing. We had a presence at road closures when it was necessary. It's interesting, when you close a road and you have signs that say road closed and there's water flowing over the road, the public still doesn't get it. And they still tend to want to drive through. And we found that we had to place people at the barricades to keep them out of places that we thought were extremely unsafe. So we manned barricades 24/7 for a period of time. Our own crews replaced washed out culverts. We removed and hauled debris with our dump trucks. We filled in eroded areas, and we had our engineering staff doing damage assessments as soon as the water began to subside. We also hired contractors to do much of the same work, things that were beyond our capability and resources, including building bridges, box culverts, road grades, and pavement, in some cases clearing debris, setting long-term detours that required significant signing materials that we didn't have on hand. We had consultants doing specific engineering designs. We hired consultants to do storm sewer inspections to make sure that the storm sewer systems were still sound after all that water rushed through them. We had a pretty large specialty contract to do soil stabilization, and we did over $11 million worth of contract work through last fall. So I want to kind of give you just a real brief summary of the most significant damage areas. And the pictures are very kind of striking to show what kind of damage we sustained. So the majority of the damage is the Highway 210 corridor from the city of Thompson to the Fond du Lac neighborhood in Duluth. There's also some damage that I'll show you in Fond du Lac itself. And then Highway 2 from Proctor to I-35, which is the portion of Highway 2 that comes down the hill into Duluth. I'll show you some photographs of that. So this Highway 210 corridor is broken into about four segments. So I'm going to break it in or show you the bridge at Thompson where we had a major washout. The next segment of the 210 we concentrated on first was the segment from the city of Thompson to the park headquarters at Jay Cook State Park. The road was washed out and the park was closed for several months. And then the next segment I'll show you is the segment that goes from the park headquarters to their picnic area at Oldenburg Point and what we have planned for that. And then the last segment of Highway 210 is the remaining 4 or 5 miles, which Minnesota Power has two power generating facilities on that corridor. We did quite a bit of emergency work last summer to provide access to their facilities. But we have a longer-term discussion about what do we do with the rest of the corridor. So this is the bridge at Thompson about 2 days after the rain stopped. There was a 14-foot diameter overflow culvert in the gap in the highway that washed out. And I can show you. This is a photograph of the nearly completed bridge that we used to replace that culvert. It was about a $1.7 million contract with Northland Construction. It just happened to be that at the same time we were rehabilitating the truss bridge right next to this location. So the contractor was already working there, and the road was closed when the flood occurred. We replaced that 14-foot diameter culvert with a 110-foot long bridge, and part of the reason we were able to get this done last year is we used salvage bridge beams that MnDOT happened to own. We own a number of temporary bridges for emergency type situations, and we use the beams from those temporary bridges along with a permanent deck to create that overflow bridge for the future. This is the worst washout that we had between the city of Thompson and the park headquarters at Jay Cook State Park. And what happened in this location, you can see a small culvert down in the bottom of the photo. This is about a 5-foot diameter culvert. This stream took all the water that flowed through the city of Thompson. So when you heard about the flooding in Thompson, where the water went over the dam and over the dikes and through the community of Thompson, all that water flowed across Highway 210 in this one location. So we lost our road there. The gap was about 40 feet deep and 180 feet long. And we ended up replacing that small diameter culvert with a, I think it's a 8 by 12 box culvert. It was a $2.5 million worth of work to reopen the road between Thompson and the state park headquarters. And it took us until October 23rd last fall to get that road restored and make it safe for the public to travel on. It's pretty amazing to me how long it took to get this road restored. There was so much damage over a course of about a mile and a quarter that we had to have several contractors working at one time to get the road opened. And the critical path of this whole process was getting that box culvert fabricated and delivered to the site. And it just took a long time. Between the park headquarters and the picnic area at the park, there's a washout. The next slide will show you a photograph of it. But we had another small culvert in a drainage, and the drainage happened to be in a place where there was a upstream a dike and a reservoir that held water that was sent down through a bunch of large culverts to a turbine at Minnesota Power's power generating facility. And the dike failed during the flood, and all the water in that reservoir drained out in about a period of 1 minute, and the water came down the hill through our road in this location. The gap there that you see was about 400 feet long and 60 feet deep, and left quite a bit of devastation. I think it was kind of interesting. One of the things I noticed the first time I went there was I found a fish on the pavement 60 feet above the bottom of that stream channel. So that wall of water that came down the hill must have been something of glacial proportions. I'm going to back up, I think. Yeah, so what we're going to end up doing in this location is replacing that culvert with this 360-foot-long bridge. We'll have about a $3.4 million project, and we're going to realign the road slightly to avoid being on the hillside that's susceptible to landslides in this location. And in the end, DNR will have a very good access to their picnic area. And the next slides, I'll discuss what else we're going to do with the Highway 210 corridor. So that project with that bridge ends at a county road called Jay Cook Road. And from Jay Cook Road to the community of Fond du Lac, Highway 210 is a scenic drive. It goes through the state park, the Jay Cook State Park. It provides access to Minnesota's power generating facility that's called Forbay, and also the dam that they operate at Fond du Lac. And we spent about $3.2 million in emergency contracts creating a driveway for Minnesota Power to get safe access to their two hydro facilities last summer. And we did it as quickly as possible because they needed to get in and get their facilities cleaned up so they could even think about generating power again at those facilities. But longer term, in this whole corridor, we need to have a discussion about what's the long-term solution. There's a legislative route that connects the city of Carlton for Highway 23 that connects the city of Carlton to Highway 23. The discussion is going to be something like there's maybe two alternatives. We could renumber some other roads and use I-35 to meet the legislative intent. And then so one alternative may be that we take the road core of Highway 210 and make a multi-use trail facility on that road core and not reconstruct the road. The other alternative would be that we reconstruct the road at a very significant cost. And I think this next picture kind of helps explain the reason why there's a very significant cost. This entire corridor for about 3 miles looks like this. It's on a very steep slope, sloping towards the St. Louis River, with a couple hundred feet of soil above the roadway and below the roadway. The road's notched into the slope. And we had soil failures that came down and covered portions of the road. And we have many, many soil failures that are still going to continue to erode because all the vegetation off of the slope up above the road is gone. And then we also have, like you see in this photograph, a lot of soil failures that started at the lower edge of the road and broke away and slid down towards the St. Louis River. And we can go in and repair all these slopes and make them fairly stable, but it's the long-term stability of those slopes is something that's going to continue to move for the rest of history, and the repairs are very, very expensive, in the tune of at least $5 million a mile. And so we want to have this discussion about what are the public values, what are the needs in that corridor, and how do people feel about the option of considering a multi-use trail and taking this portion of the scenic drive off of our trunk highway system. The next thing I thought I'd talk about is the Highway 2 from Proctor to Boundary Avenue, which is basically, or Proctor in Boundary Avenue down to I-35. That pavement on that hill was undermined and washed out. We ended up having a $3.1 million construction project to replace a half a mile of pavement. It's four lanes wide. We did a complete reconstruction. We had to replace a box culvert with a 10 by 16 box culvert. We were able to open the road on November 8th, which is pretty remarkable to do the design, get the materials, and have it completed by last fall. It was a lot of work. Our contracting process happened to be a lot of work because of the way that we chose to do the contracting on this one. But this is a pretty good descriptor of what we had to start with after the flood. This photograph here, with the pavement, the edge of the pavement undermined. Some of it was almost full width across the four lanes of Highway 2. But for the whole half mile, we lost portions of the pavement, and it all needed to be reconstructed. The last area I'll talk about is the Fond du Lac neighborhood, and this is the south side of the Fond du Lac neighborhood. So to the north in this picture, or to the left in the photograph, is the St. Louis River. And this is an overflow channel, a historic overflow channel of the St. Louis River. We have a small, about 8-foot diameter box culvert under the highway that normally would carry all the flow that might come through during a large flood event. In this case, with 50, the quantity of flow in the river was 55,000 cubic feet per second. The overflow channel opened up and carried much more water than we had previously ever seen. There had been past floods of 39,000 cubic feet per second, but this was significantly higher, 30% higher than what we had seen before. So this is kind of an indicator of the problems in the Fond du Lac neighborhood. We had water flowing in places that we normally didn't see, and it went through and around homes and in that neighborhood and caused quite a bit of significant damage. On the lower end, this is Highway 23 that you're looking at, and where that waterfall is, that's the edge of our pavement as it's being undermined and eroded by the flow of the water. And this last slide is a photograph of a bridge called Mission Creek Bridge, which is right in the Fond du Lac neighborhood. This is after the water subsided and we cleaned up most of the debris. You can still see a lot of the woody debris here in this stream channel. This particular stream flows through a neighborhood of about 30 homes. And during the flood, this bridge collected all this woody debris, and it actually had collected trees for a distance of about three city blocks. Was solid timber. And the timber forced the stream to jump out of its normal channel and flow through the neighborhood. So not only was the water high, but the velocity of the stream flowing through a series of homes and down the city streets caused a lot of damage in that neighborhood. MnDOT put in quite a bit of effort working with the city of Duluth doing mutual aid work to clean up the city streets in this neighborhood. And there's going to has to be a long-term discussion about what do we do with this stream so that it passes the woody debris rather than collecting it and endangering that neighborhood again to another flood. So we have to have a discussion about what to do with this bridge. There's another bridge. I mentioned there was significant rainfall up near Two Harbors. And the Silver Creek Bridge just north of Two Harbors had a similar issue where it plugged up with woody debris and overflowed Highway 61, causing us to close Highway 61 for about a day. And in that same location, or in that location, we need to have the same discussion about replacing the box culverts at Silver Creek with a bridge that will pass woody debris. And in that particular location, DNR also would be really interested in building a bridge that allows the trout to have a easier access swimming up above Highway 61. We've got a couple more slides to just discuss the local agency or the local system damage. On our state aid system, there were over 1,000 miles of local roads that were damaged and over 225 structures. Our local cities and counties have worked really hard to prepare plans to do reconstruction, and two-thirds of the permanent repairs are planned for this coming summer. The remaining one-third should be completed in 2014. As part of this process, one of the things that MnDOT offered to help with the local agencies was a bridge inspection program. MnDOT was overwhelmed by this event, but the cities and counties with the smaller engineering staffs were certainly even more overwhelmed. And one of the things that we learned after the I-35 bridge collapse was that using our consultant community to help us with bridge inspection is a viable thing. And we helped the local agencies manage a local agency-wide bridge inspection contract. We had six consultants teams that were managed by SEH Incorporated. They inspected 177 local bridges in a period of about 2 weeks. They were able to do all the detailed damage reports on those bridges and do all the documentation necessary for federal and FEMA emergency relief funding for the local agencies. And then because they had firsthand knowledge about those bridges, they were also in a very good position to develop repair plans if that was necessary and what the local agencies wanted. There were 58 structures that were inspected by our local agencies. Those were basically the ones that were gone, and it was really easy to say it's a total loss. But the ones that were less significantly damaged were the ones where you had to put a lot more engineering work into the inspection and into the documentation process, and that's where this consultant team really helped out. So I got an updated number here. There's going to be 64 local bridges that will be replaced or have major rehabilitation, and the cost of those projects is going to be slightly more than $22 million. And then we have 75 other local structures with minor damage that will be repaired. And if you have any questions, I'd be happy to try to answer them right now.
Thank you, Mr. Hill and Senator Reinert. And if I can just offer a firsthand testimonial, I happened to be up on the Gunflint Trail when that happened. So I was on the other side of the worst of it. And I think if I recall correctly, the worst of the storm was Tuesday night, Wednesday morning.
Right.
And we drove back all the way from, Gunflint Trail, Grand Marais, down 61 through Duluth, down to the Twin Cities on Friday. And we did that on purpose, having listened to the radio reports. And I will say, with the exception of the one detour on 61 at Knife River, it was amazing because you could see all the patchworks that had been done and all the repairs to keep the traffic moving down that main artery throughout the state. So congratulations to everybody involved because it was very impressive.
Thank you.
Members, any other questions or comments? Senator Dibble?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Let me just echo your comments of commendation. This is an impressive presentation. I have myself been witness to some disasters, but nothing on this scale. And to see how MnDOT and the city and the counties and so many other agencies came together, not just around the infrastructure, but particularly around the infrastructure and the roadway system. And to your earlier comment, Senator Reinert, to see how the rest of the state responded, how legislators on the south just kind of stepped up, it was impressive, and it was really a proud moment You know, it's difficult in these, you know, you don't wish these circumstances for these circumstances at all. And to the extent that we look for silver linings, we got a silver lining here. We once again reminded ourselves, you know, that we have really, really effective public agencies, public services, communities that work well. And at the end of the day, despite our differences, the things that unite us are much more important. So thank you. And please bring our commendations and our gratitude back to your staff, Mr. Hill.
I will. Thank you very much.
Madam Chair.
Senator Franzen.
Madam Chair, thank you. Just wanted to follow up. We were just talking here amongst ourselves how impressed we are of what you accomplished in such a short time frame. You mentioned 2 weeks, and you inspected 64 bridges and all the things that you patched together. You have those outcomes. How many people were involved? I mean, not even counting volunteers and neighbors, but from your records, how many people from the agencies were actually involved? FEMA, MnDOT, what level of personnel that you have?
I can speak for my own agency. We have, in addition to this flood, we had our biggest construction program ever. If you drove on I-35 last summer, you could see a lot of our work on I-35. We had $140 million worth of construction work ongoing when the flood hit. Our staff in our district is slightly over 350 employees, and every one of them had a role in this recovery of this flood. In addition, I mentioned we had staff come from other parts of the state to help with our initial response. And then during the duration with the engineering design, we had support from here in St. Paul with our bridge office, our foundations office, our technical support people, our contracting people, our finance people, our administration. It was amazing the support that we had within our agency. And everybody pulled together, and it's so gives you such a good feeling to see how people respond in a really tough situation, and what great teamwork that we had among our employees. And I never heard anyone complain. And one of the interesting things about this flood that was really a disaster for our part of the state was there was nobody killed, mm-hmm. and there were not that I heard of even serious injuries attributed to the flood. And I can look at the hours that my employees worked. We had no injuries. Everybody really looked out for each other and made sure that they were safe, and yet did a lot of really important work.
Thank you. Thank you for your leadership, Madam Chair and presenters.
So, Senator Reinert, how are things now? What's going on?
Madam Chair, Senator Dibble, things are well. I think Mr. Hill sort of highlighted where we are in terms of the infrastructure recovery. I think that's probably where we're on the best path. We're struggling a little bit more with the number of homes that were damaged and trying to find the right way to assist various homeowners. You know, the first line of defense on that is an application of the Small Business Administration and those loans which are low interest, but not no interest loans. And so we've had some people that have not taken that option when it's probably the best option for them. And that's led to some underutilization of monies we had expected in the special session. So we still have work to do there. What we don't want is that housing stock just laying dormant or worse, being abandoned. And it's not as serious an issue in Duluth as it is in Senator Lurie's district south of us, again, in communities like Moose Lake, where a significant percentage of the housing stock was impacted. But things are well. And I really do want to emphasize again how important it was, the infrastructure work that was done. You heard in one of the videos me trying to say, you know, don't cancel your plans to visit us. And I think most of you know, or if you don't, are not surprised that Duluth does a lot of tourism in the summer. It's a major sector of our economy, a major sector of city revenue. And so a quick crisis became, we might have the storm, and then we might have all the cancellations at the peak of the summer tourist season. And so a couple things were important. Number one, us as elected officials and community leaders getting out and telling folks, come visit us. You know, best thing you can do right now is come to Duluth and spend some money. But secondly, it was knowing that folks could get there. And the word quickly got around that, as Senator Kent said, that you could get up there. It wasn't Katrina. The roads weren't completely washed out. You know, the lasting images of the sinkhole, which happened to be a couple blocks from Mayor Ness's house, the seal on Grand Avenue, you know, those were in the middle of the flood. And within a couple days, with the help of great staff who, as Dwayne said, didn't ask whose job it was, didn't ask who was supposed to do it, you know, just did it. And one of the lasting memories I will have of the storm, and a testament to that, was it was the firefighters who were out at 3 a.m. The night of the storm collecting animals from the zoo. Just who was there? Who had the vehicle? Who could get there? That's who did the work. And it was really that sense of teamwork and spirit that got temporary patches in place and have really got us, in many cases, ahead of schedule on repair projects. The number of times that a message has come out from MnDOT saying this road is open and it's ahead of schedule, I think that's been more the case than not.
Senator Dibble?
Well, Senator Reiner, I'll be up for the race this summer.
Chair and Senator Dibble, the course is good. Hopefully you got your lottery notice today.
I'm running the full, so.
Oh, good. Then I know I'll beat you.
You keep reminding us of that, yeah, Senator. Yeah.
You should get Senator Miller to run it, too. He's a runner.
Madam Chair, Senator Dibble, I don't think I'll be prepared to run a marathon this summer.
Oh, Madam Chair.
Family situation.
You can race the half with the... They'll keep for a half a day. Right?
Very good. Any other questions, comments?
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, thank you.
Thank you both.
Hey, members, we'll move on to Senate File 377. Senator Peterson. Take about 5-10 minutes, non-controversial bill. I'm going to put it on the consent calendar, right? Welcome, Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, today we have before you Senate File 3. It's Senate File 377. And I do have a delete all A1 amendment, if we could get that passed out. And then, Mr. Chair, I would like to just rearrange the schedule a little bit if we could, because I have the mayor of St. Cloud and the police chief of St. Cloud need to be on the road by 4 o'clock here. And so
Absolutely.
If I could bring them up right now to give their testimony, well, members will have a chance to look at the A1 amendment. What we have in that amendment, I'll run through that after this first two testifiers to show you that many of the concerns some of you had shared with me the last week or so, or 10 days or a couple weeks, have been addressed in that amendment. So,
right,
with that,
Senator
up,
Peterson moves the A1 amendment. It is an author's amendment. It is the bill's first hearing in its Committee of Original Jurisdiction. Does everyone have the amendment? We'll wait just a second for it to come around. All right. All in favor of the A1, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, no. Motion passes. Senator, welcome, Mayor. Welcome back to the Senate. Mayor, Senator Kleiss.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Dave Kleiss, Mayor of the City of St. Cloud. And it's an honor to be back here and testifying on behalf of Senate File 377. This is a bill that... Actually, the concept of the cameras is something that I supported when I was here, so before I was mayor, and even more so as mayor, for a number of reasons. Probably the number one reason is the issue of public safety. This is a problem, and I come from the area of public safety, and I'm going to have Chief talk a little bit about, from a law enforcement perspective, that piece of public safety. But I can speak on the issue of public safety and traffic safety because I've owned a driver's education business for over 23 years and haven't taught much lately. But when I was able to teach. This is the issue, you know, as safety, folks that run red lights. In fact, I used to have my class when I taught. I would send them out to an intersection nearby with their little notepads and take notes of all the cars that run a red light. Obviously, if there was a squad car there, folks are a little bit more apprehensive of doing that. Even more so if there was a sign that said red light camera or a red light camera, they'd be more likely not to run the red light. But some 15-year-olds with notepads really didn't stop anyone. So they used to jot down a number of folks, and it was an issue of safety, and you're going to hear some testimony, I know, also about that issue. So it's a matter of public safety from a city's perspective, and it's also a matter of resources. We have, as you wrestle with financial issues, revenue and expenditures, we as cities still have that same requirement to balance our budget. I'm required to have a budget to our city council in August. We have to put those budgets together based on difficult choices and resources. We get oftentimes community and citizens will ask us to prioritize and look at. In fact, I don't think there's a week that goes by that I don't have somebody in the community asking us to enforce public safety, and in particular traffic safety. We just, when it comes to, we will, even with this bill, this was to pass and we had cameras at some intersections, we'd still be out there dealing with traffic safety issues. But we wouldn't have the resources, nor would it be prudent to have a cop at every intersection where there's a traffic light. We have a lot of other issues, whether they be assaults or burglaries or other things that are higher priority. Traffic's still part of it. So what I like, and as a community, our officers, and this is something that we've surveyed the community as to whether or not traffic safety is important, and people feel it is. I've talked to a number of our line officers, and they want to have extra tools. I see this as a tool. We as a city have to deal with resources and, again, put budgets together, become more and more difficult. I don't think I'd ever have an Mr. Chair, since I have the opportunity. I always can use more local government aid. As a city, we'd never turn that down. But with the dwindling resources, we still have to provide those public safety. It's an expectation that anyone has in any community in the state that there is a certain level of public safety. And we'd like to have the tools to enforce that. So we're supportive of having the cameras. And this would be something that we would make a determination as to where we put them. This is something I've been asked, if we have cameras, will we put them at every intersection? Quite frankly, no. We do have a couple of intersections in St. Cloud, and the chief will talk about that. We're listed under MnDOT's most dangerous intersections in the state. So there's a couple of candidates where we might want to put some. But, on more than likely, we'd have two, maybe three in our entire city. But it would be those intersections where not only there are people who run red lights and it's dangerous for other motorists, but also, quite frankly, for our officers to pull somebody over at a very busy intersection is also problematic and also dangerous to those officers. So it would allow us the opportunity and the tool. Right now, state statute prohibits it, so we don't have that opportunity to have that type of technology and that type of tool. So it's an issue of local, we'd like to have that local control or that local issue at the local level. I know this issue is one that oftentimes, I think, even 8 years ago when I was here, creates some controversy on folks that feel one way or the other on this issue. But I think that debate is best at the local communities where those decisions can be made as to the best tools that we can use to provide public safety. We'd certainly still have to pass an ordinance. We'd still have to have a public hearing. We'd still have to make the determination whether or not we put cameras in. We'd still have to determine the budgetary aspects of putting in the cameras and determining where they should go, if they should go at all. But we'd still like to have that opportunity. The other issue, when I talk about resources, I think it's important to say, because I've heard some folks talk about, cities want to have these cameras because it's all about revenue. I would disagree extremely with that issue. I supported this when I was a legislator before I was a mayor of a city. This is an issue of public safety. When it comes to the cameras, first of all, if someone runs a red light, we don't get all the revenue. A lot of that goes to a surcharge that goes to the state. But we wouldn't even have a problem if you had an amendment, all the money can go. We'd prefer to actually not collect a dime. We would prefer people not running red lights, and that's the issue. It's a matter of public safety. We don't put together ordinances and fines so that we can collect revenue. They are to provide for a change in behavior in this issue for public safety. So we're strongly supportive of Senate File 377 with that from the public safety piece. I want to introduce my chief, William Blair Anderson, to give those comments.
Welcome, Chief Blair Anderson.
Thank you.
Is that right, Chief Blair Anderson?
That's correct,
okay.
Mr. Chairman. Thank you all for your time today. For the record, my name is William Blair Anderson. I'd just like to add to Mayor Kleiss's comments. There are many reasons to support this legislation right here. A few of the more salient points from my point of view is that the deterrent factor cannot be overstated. You know, oftentimes one of the primary goals for us enforcing traffic law is to change behavior, contrary to public belief. We are more interested in changing people's driving behavior than punishing them for making mistakes. You know, as a peace officer, I know all too well how horrible it is to make death notifications. And, you know, when it's something so senseless, something that we have tools to help us prevent, I think we would be remiss if we didn't avail ourselves of that technology. It certainly isn't without controversy, but so are a lot of the tools we use, but that does not mean they are not effective. And you guys will get some more information with respect to the data. But for us in law enforcement, public safety is our number one priority. And, you know, the paradigm has shifted for us. And, you know, as such, because of the nature and complexity of the things that we are asked to do now, we need a more efficient and effective way to render services. And these are the kinds of tools that help us do that. You know, the return on whatever the investment is more than worth it if it helps us prevent one crash and save one life. You know, this is something that's already being used. And again, it changes behavior. I have noticed myself personally, not that I run red lights, but when I am in a state or a city where these are in use, you're a little bit more conscientious about your behavior just knowing that that technology is being used. So we are in strong support of this legislation primarily because it assists us in carrying out our primary mission, which is public safety.
Thank you, Chief Blair Anderson. Members, any questions for the chief or the mayor? Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Senator Peterson, Mayor Kleiss, and Chief Blair Anderson, I'm glad to have you here today. I think we all are commonly concerned about public safety and representing the entities you do, but also speaking on behalf of our citizens and some of the concerns they have. They have the same goal as you have in many cases. We just want to be sure we have a balanced approach. One of the things in reading the Highway Safety Research and Communications, it talked about the value, sometimes 12% decline of these kinds of violations when you modify the traffic signals for yellow and all red. There's an ITE guidelines. And I'm just wondering, have you implemented that, since you're here specifically for one city, have you implemented those guidelines in your city? Because in one case here it was fell 12% these violations, another one 36%. There are a couple different studies here. So have you implemented that? I mean, we all share that concern. And so here's a very, you already do this. By using ITI guidelines, you can reduce these crashes even without a camera situation. So have you taken those steps?
Mr. Chair and Senator Kiffmeyer, you're going to hear some testimony, I think, a little bit more that talks about increasing the yellow lights. In fact, studies have shown, it's probably in the same studies that you're reading, that when you lengthen the yellow and add the camera, you have a significant reduction. But I'm not a traffic engineer, and neither is the chief. And the fact that our traffic engineer on a regular basis either lengthens lights, times lights, and the issue of the yellow timing. It would be the technology and based on those expertise. But you'll hear a little testimony a little bit later about where the timing of the yellow. There's always a caution, though, with the timing of the yellow. If the yellow light is too long, there's an expectation that prior to getting to the intersection, well, I can certainly make it because that yellow light is very long. So it actually could create even more of a hazard. That's why there are engineers that study this. And the nice thing about the cameras, and you'll hear it also, is there are over 500 cities in the United States that have had these for a long time. So there's enough data in the books as far as with the yellow lights and with the cameras to dictate whether the safety piece of it. But.
Thank you.
Well, Mr. Chair, I appreciate that. Mayor, I do think that as policy setters, you know, you establish policies. And so, the technical things are done by the technical folks, but policy setting is really important. And I like the idea of saving money and saving crashes at every level you can, and I understand. But the specific studies here, an institute study in Philadelphia, was a 36% reduction. Now, it says here just the longer yellow light reduced the red light violations in that regards. And it did say also, in all fairness, that adding camera enforcement further cut red light running by another 96%. So I appreciate what you're saying there, but I don't think it negates the value of doing the low cost, the most low cost, where you already have it, and to function with that. But I thought maybe in your particular city, since this was right here and part of the studies presented, you might have just happened to know for this committee. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Senator Peterson.
Mr. Chair, if there were not any more questions for Mayor Kleiss or Chief Anderson, they do have a city council meeting to get to, and so if members didn't have any more questions for them, we would ask that they be excused, and then I would take moments to go through the bill and the amendment that I offered earlier.
So Senator Kleiss, you're going to hop that North Star train up to St. Cloud. Oh, yeah, never mind.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to do that. Really would. We're not going to speed, and we're not going to run any red lights.
All right.
So we need time to do that. But, Mr. Chair, just one thing on Senator Kiffmeyer's point, and we would appreciate that. That is the purview of the legislature to set policy and with those traffic engineers and those experts to those timings. That would be another tool that we would like. But for us, it's just a matter of having the tools. Right now, we're prevented from having some of those tools, and anything we can do at the local level, I think, is always better. Thank you.
I think Senator Wigger had something.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Mayor Kleiss, has your city council passed a resolution? And if so, what was the vote?
Mr. Chair and Senator Wigger. We actually have. I failed to mention that in my testimony. But we've had a resolution ever since I've been mayor, and it's been unanimous every year. So a resolution to allow I believe it's been 7 years. Where we passed a resolution unanimously to allow this as one of our legislative agenda items for the legislature to support our ability to do it. We'd still have to have a public hearing, of course, and pass an ordinance change, but we have passed a resolution in that respect.
Great. And thanks, members. That
Mr.
is
Chair.
In the packet. Senator Westrom.
Mr. Chair, real quick. Mayor Kleiss, if we allowed this, what else could you use it for, and where would this stop?
Peterson or whomever
Senator
would like
Westrom,
to field
the- we're asking just, I can tell you, we're asking for the authorization for the camera, which would only be utilized if someone violates the law. In fact, the cameras do not take the photo unless you've actually ran a red light. Which, from my understanding, I don't believe there's any right to run a red light, and I think it's quite frankly deters my rights as a motorist if you do. So we're advocating for this and this this alone, this ability, this tool to do this. With the technology, and as technology changes, that's one of the things that's the purview of the legislature. Technology has changed over the year. You think about radar guns years ago when they first came out, and how controversial just pointing that device at a vehicle and determining whether or not that's a speed or not, it was a technology. Those technologies change over a period of time, but we're just asking for this piece.
Senator Westrom.
So what else? I know you're under. You're just asking for red lights, but
under the bill, Mr.
King, parking and meters that are no parking zones. I mean, what else could you conceivably use it for down the road,
Senator Peterson?
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Senator Westrom, I can take a stab at that. I think to try and ease some of your concerns. I mean, certainly these are cameras. But that could be modified for other uses. But I can assure you any modification is something that the City Council may or may not decide to do. The camera we're talking about today is not a spy camera. It only takes a photo when somebody runs a red light. It's that simple and will not do anything else in a community without the City Council going through extensive public hearing process and other steps to modify those cameras, if that were the case. I think that's, does that answer your question?
All right. Thank you. Senator Franz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then for Mr. I don't know who can answer the question, but basically in the statute or the bill proposed has language of holding the information data for up to 30 days. Can you elaborate a little bit of that? From my understanding, there is a recommendation from the Minnesota Chiefs of Police of 180 days, so I'm not sure if that's consistent with that.
Mr. Chair and Senator Franz, and I can address that. Was going to try and do that as we moved through the bill, and so I really appreciate this question. You know, the data is absolutely, members, this data is absolutely protected and then will be destroyed. This bill would require that any data that's collected in this process after the final adjudication of the ticket would be destroyed within 30 days. I have talked with the Police Chiefs Association leading up to this bill. They are neutral on this bill up to this point. They have another board meeting and plan to talk about this before it moves into judiciary or a hearing potentially in judiciary. And so they would likely, I heard from them back today, actually this morning, they would likely be taking a position on this bill as it moves forward.
So members, if you have a cell phone up on the table anywhere, if you can stick it back behind you, like mine is back here, that helps with the fuzzy interference.
Mr. Chair, I missed the last portion of what.
I did hear back from the executive director of the Police Chiefs Association this morning, and they have not. They're neutral on the bill right now and have not taken a strong position, but we'll be talking about it before this bill would end up in judiciary, if that's the case.
Searching. Thank you. Anything further for the mayor or the chief, so that they can get on the road? Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I believe that, you know, this can be answered by anyone, but I guess because we have a city involved here, I'd like to know, how do you plan to pay the contractor if you do intend to employ a contractor? Will that come out of the tag value, or do you have another arrangement with them? And also, I'll follow up with another question later.
Mayor. Mr. Chair and Senator, we at this point don't have arrangement with anyone. We'd certainly do this like any other equipment that we would buy, whether we're buying tasers or buying the lights themselves or any other type of public safety. So we'd take that out to bids and come up with some type of agreement or contract with it. But we haven't even explored. We haven't done any exploring as to what's out there. It would be a lot of, at this point anyways, resources that we'd be wasting, since state law prohibits us from having the cameras, so we haven't done a lot of research. We know they're out there. We've done a research as to what their effectiveness is, but we haven't at this point. But we would go through a process, competitively bid, and go through a process to determine what the best bang for the buck is for us. And we, you know, determining, first of all, whether it fits into our budget. again, even with the authorization of the cameras, we may not put up any cameras if we feel financially it, you know, we'll weigh that based on the resources we have on an annual basis and determine whether that's not. But I can tell you, based on the track record of some of the intersections, there's a couple that would that we would look at potentially. And some of our intersections that are the most problematic are not only city, but they're also state. So there may be, in that respect, there may be something that's cooperatively done with the counties or potentially with MnDOT, because some of those intersections are actually MnDOT intersections. But MnDOT would be prohibited. But if the city had authorization, I assume they would then have authorization to put those. So but we haven't explored that piece of it yet.
Mr. Chair and
Senator Carlson.
Mayor Kleiss, then, but you do intend to look on the outside to do the reviewing of the data before a ticket is issued?
Mr. Chair and Senator, from what my understanding is the way the technology works, a photo is taken, and I think with the amendment, a photo is taken of the license plate and the driver. Our officers would actually look at those photos and make sure that the photos match up with the driver's license photos. So a police officer would actually make the issuing of the ticket through our process.
Mr. Chair and
Senator Carlson.
Mayor Kleiss. You're saying that the officer would be the one that does the filter, or would there be anybody on the outside that would be involved?
Under my, Mr. Chair and Senator, and my understanding, again, we'd be that would be something that we would be having that opportunity to review that before a ticket is issued.
Mr. Chair, I have a question. And pardon me for not being here for the entire presentation, but what is on the amendment, Section 13.05, Subdivision 11? What is that?
What line are you looking at?
I'm sorry, I'm looking at line 2.21 on the amendment.
Senate Counsel, could you help us? 13.05 Subdivision 11, contract with a private entity.
Mr. Chair and Senator Carlson, that subdivision deals with privatization, and what it says is that when the government contracts with a private party, that private party takes on the same duties with regard to data privacy that would normally attach to the government entity if it were performing that function on its own.
Okay. And Senator Carlson.
So, Mr. Chair, that means that an outside company would have the authorization by this particular item C there. They would have the authorization to get into the driver's license files. Is that correct?
Ms. Berezovsky.
Mr. Chair and Senator Carlson, I don't think that particular clause would have that effect. I think that paragraph C merely says that if there is a contract with a private entity to operate the cameras, that private entity has to treat the images from the cameras with the same privacy as the government has to treat them.
Thank you. And Mr. Chair, I guess Ms. Berezovsky, is there anything in this language that allows the driver's license data file to be presented or used by an outside contractor?
Ms. Berezovsky.
Mr. Chair and Senator Carlson, I don't believe that there is that specific authorization, and I don't believe that there is a specific prohibition either in this bill.
Thank you.
All right, anything further? Senator Peterson.
Mr. Chair and Senator Carlson, I would add that these cameras can cost up to $150,000, so I think members should be assured that this is not a decision any city council is going to take lightly. It's not an inexpensive process. But the good news is there's over 9 different companies that produce these types of cameras, and so you can be assured that your city councils and local governments will be in a situation to be able to offer a very competitive bid if they would choose to move forward under this situation. And absolutely, your local community's police department will be the decision maker in terms of whether a ticket gets sent out to one of your residents or not. The decision will not be made by anybody else other than your local police department.
All right. Anything further for the mayor or the chief? We have to get on the road. Safely on the road. All right.
Thank you, Mayor. Thank you, Chief.
Committee members.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. Appreciate your time today.
Thank you. Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. With that, I'd just like to move through the rest of the amendment to clarify, and hopefully it'll answer a number of the questions that you may have in your mind right now. That was really the intent of the amendment, and I appreciate you allowing them to accommodate their schedules to get back and do the work of the residents in the city that they serve. You'll see in the delete all amendment, the A1 amendment, we clearly, in section one, we clearly define what a traffic safety camera is. It is a camera that positively identifies both the driver and the vehicle through the license plate tag that the vehicle has on it. And if you turn that over, the rest of the bill you see on the front side there is essentially existing law that we have in Minnesota right now. If you turn the page over in section three, it addresses the concern that Senator Carlson just brought up. You'll see that the police will absolutely, the local police department will be the agency issuing the ticket, nobody else. You'll see in subdivision two is the sign requirement. Your residents, if a community decides to go down this path, there will be signs that notify them that the cameras are at the intersection that they're approaching. And then the next under subsection three, under data, Senator Franzen asked the question that we addressed there. The data of your constituents and residents of Minnesota will absolutely be protected and then destroyed shortly thereafter the ticket is adjudicated. And then finally, an exception, the bottom of subdivision four, which really exempts this type of action, this type of ticket. Currently in Minnesota, you may know that with three petty misdemeanors, there's some additional penalties that come into play there. And we do not want the folks that are getting tickets through the traffic camera situation to fall under those categories. So it exempts this type of ticket, much like seatbelts are, from of the three petty misdemeanor rules that are in place right now in law. With that, members, I think you've gotten the message loud and clear up to this point that this bill is really about local control and public safety. And I won't continue to belabor those points made very clearly and eloquently by a local official that has served in this body in the past, but it's important to note that two of the largest cities that I serve absolutely support this bill in the district that I'm from and represent. And I believe if you support this bill as well and move it onto judiciary this afternoon, you will find that many of your communities support it as well when given the opportunity to do what we're considering giving them the permission to do. It's important to know what this bill does not do. This bill does not eliminate police officer jobs. These are not spy cameras, as we discussed. These cameras only go on and take a photo when there is a traffic violation, when somebody breaks the law. This bill is not about one company. As I've said, there's nine different companies that produce these cameras, and this bill is certainly not about, as you may hear later this afternoon, folks that are violating the law. It's not about creating them or painting them as victims. The people that choose to run red lights, members are not the victims, quite frankly. They're the ones breaking the law. And as we've had this discussion, if I've had this discussion, certainly if we choose and have the freedom to run a red light in Minnesota, those same residents certainly understand the consequence of running that light, which certainly is and can be property damage. It can be death and injury and certainly a ticket if they choose to violate the law in that way. And then finally, as I mentioned to Senator Carlson, this law is not about putting a camera on every corner with a red light, with a traffic light. It's simply not possible. It's not feasible because of the cost associated with those lights. I should also note, in my community, the insurance industry and statewide does support this bill. Clearly, it does been demonstrated, and you have that study in your information there as well, that this does reduce accidents and ultimately will put a situation in to hopefully allow insurance companies to continue to provide competitive rates. The less money they pay out as an insurance company, in theory, the lower their rates and their premiums will be. And I'd also encourage you to check with the senior organizations in your communities. Where I'm from, we have the Central Minnesota Council on Aging, who represents about 14 different counties in Central Minnesota. And the information I've seen from them in recent years really shows the residents in my district that are age 60, are 60 years of age and older, is nearing, is between 15% to 20% of our population. And the feedback I have from them as well is that they support this bill. Please understand it's a serious situation, and it's a public safety situation, as we discussed. You'll also see in your packet there, you'll see over 7,000 people have been injured. Folks, this is just in 1 year. Just last year, in 2011, over 7,000, actually nearly 8,000, there's about 7,600 people have been injured in intersection accidents, 23 of who have actually been killed. And you'll hear from folks that have firsthand knowledge on that. You've already heard from the mayor and the police chief in St. Cloud, where I'm from. Now we're going to have a couple brief videos, Madam Chair, and then we'll have a number of other testifiers that will introduce themselves as they come on up, as well as an expert on this technology to answer any further questions you might have. And then finally, the advocates that will work with me to encourage you to support this bill and move it on to the Judiciary Committee next.
Sitting here talking to you, I wouldn't be participating in an effort to save the red light cameras. This is about safety. We cannot address, if we had just left law enforcement with an officer walking on the sidewalk swinging a nightstick, and we hadn't changed the way we approach law enforcement for all these years, as technology changes, as vehicles become more prevalent, as phones become more prevalent, we have to change with the times. We're not just having the officer on the sidewalk anymore. We have them in cars. We have them watching camera systems to see if crimes are occurring. We have them monitoring red lights through red light cameras.
People who become aware that the technology is in use in our community, they drive better at that intersection and the other intersections around it.
4-year-old Maya Hirsch was killed as she left the Lincoln Park Zoo this weekend with her family. Well, tonight, as police move closer to charging that person of interest, CBS 2's Rafael Romo explains many are using the tragedy as a lesson in safety.
When they're behind the wheel, they're trying to get where they're going. And I think that it's, conditions people to be more watchful.
I think it's important that it's a tool we can use, much like radar, much like DNA, much like all the other technology that has been emerging.
It's one thing to see a video from some other community and say, well, this problem's happening here, and another to see it actually happening in your own town.
We learned that there was 115 violations a day in a 12-hour period. Since the time we've installed the camera there now, our violations are less than 300 a month. It's a substantial reduction in the risk to the pedestrians and the motors there, and it's been an effective program.
I thought that I'd seen pretty much everything until I started watching some of these videos, and then I look at the videos and I'm flabbergasted. We've had videos of cars going 50 miles an hour through a solid red light, inches from the back end of a car going on the cross street, and it just chills you that there wasn't an accident.
If one life is saved, if one 4.5-year-old girl, you know, someone's daughter, someone's sibling, someone's friend is not killed by the presence of these lights or these cameras, then their value is proven.
Mr. Chair and members, we have one more video, and then we would, Mr. Chair and members, we have one more video, and then we would ask that you I would invite up Melanie Castellano Swanson.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and
proceed. Thank you. My name is Melanie Castellano Swanson. Could you hear me? You want me to just start reading? My name is Melanie, and I'm a certified medical assistant at Hennepin County Medical Center. I'm here to speak about the importance of traffic safety cameras on behalf of my profession, as well as my son, Justin. Justin was killed on Christmas Eve, 2011. Witnesses say a Ford SUV ran a red light and broadsided a pickup truck, which spun into oncoming traffic, and the SUV rolled over two other vehicles, including the car my 29-year-old son was in. Justin was killed instantly. Six people were taken to Rice Memorial Hospital with injuries that afternoon. The driver of the SUV happened to be from South Dakota. He happened to be a 15-year-old with a valid driver's license, according to South Dakota law, but this driver also ran a red light, killing my son. His decision left Justin's 11-year-old son without a father, and his fiance, who was 8 months pregnant at the time of the crash, without the love of her life. We now have a 1-year-old granddaughter, and I can see Justin in her eyes. The driver could be anyone on the road, an experienced 50-year-old driver in a hurry, or any one of us. This could happen to anyone. I will never be able to quantify the emotional and physical loss of Justin to my family. However, there are statistics that begin to show you the impact red light running has had on our state's roadways. In 2011, according to the Minnesota Department of Public Safety, 23 people were killed in a crash when disregard for a traffic control device contributed to the crash. My son was one of those people. Another 7,668 people were injured from a crash involving a traffic signal in 2011. These statistics about death and injury caused by red light runners are staggering. The Insurance Institute for Highway Safety released a study on January 25th of this year confirming the benefits of red light cameras. Researchers found red light running rates declined at Arlington County, Virginia, intersections equipped with cameras. The decreases were particularly large for the most dangerous violations, those happening 1.6
1.5 seconds or longer after the light turned red. It is time we take red light running seriously. We need to use modern technology to crack down on drivers who ignore the red lights and kill innocent people with their criminal acts. Red light cameras change driver behavior, prevent injuries and fatalities, and penalize those who break the law. Red light cameras work, and Minnesota cities need this technology. I stand before you today as an advocate for photo enforcement in Minnesota, but also as a mother who believes December 24th, 2011, would have been another Christmas Eve and not the day I lost my son if a camera had been at the intersections of Highway 7 and 71 in Willmar. There's no reason another family should have to endure the loss of a son, daughter, or parent to someone who refuses to obey the law. Sorry, I didn't mean to get emotional.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Castellanos-Swanson.
You're welcome.
Our condolences. We're sorry for your loss, and we thank you for having the courage to come forward and tell us your story.
If I can prevent this to happen, or prevent anyone having to go through this kind of a tragedy, I'll do anything I can. I can't bring Justin back, but I can make a difference in changing somebody else's life.
Well, you're honoring him very well.
Thank you.
Anything, members? Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Next, we have Mr. Craig Buskey, who is really an expert in this technology and can answer, has some testimony, and then can answer any further questions folks may have in regard to this equipment.
Welcome, Mr. Buskey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Senators. My name is Craig Buskey. I'm a lawyer here in Minneapolis at the law office of David Shulman, and I work in part for Redflex Traffic Systems, which is one of the nine companies Senator Peterson mentioned that make these types of cameras. I've already heard testimony about why these are important. I'm here primarily to go over some of the legal issues associated with the cameras, give an overview of the technology for how the camera systems work, and then answer any questions you might have the best I'm able. I'd like to start with a legal issue, and that's that the opponents of the use of these cameras frequently say things like, well, aren't these unconstitutional? These are unconstitutional. And Senators, that's simply not the case. I think that misunderstanding comes from confusion about what the 2007 Minnesota Supreme Court case State v. Kuhlman was about. Now, a copy of that case is in the informational packets you all received. It's a 2007 case, and it deals with a challenge to the Minneapolis ordinances that governed their red light camera program. Now, what the holding of that case was that the Minneapolis ordinances were invalid because they were in conflict with state law. That case did not address constitutional issues, so it's a misunderstanding to say, oh, they held it unconstitutional. The reasons that the state Supreme Court held that the Minneapolis ordinances were invalid were because they conflicted with state law primarily in three ways. One, they said that the municipality did not have authorization from the legislature to use cameras to enforce traffic laws. Two, they said it was a conflict that the Minneapolis ordinances issued the ticket to the owner of the vehicle, not the driver. And three, they said it was a conflict with state law that the Minneapolis ordinances had a presumption that the owner of the vehicle was the driver. Well, Senators, what Senate File 377 does is provides a framework to use traffic safety cameras in a way that it avoids all of the problems that the court found in the Kuhlman case. It authorizes municipalities to use traffic safety cameras, and it does so in a way that avoids the other problems. You'll notice that the definition of a traffic safety camera specifies that it must be able to take a clear image of the driver of the vehicle as well as the motor vehicle itself. And that's because the ticket goes to the driver, not the owner, to the driver. It's a petty misdemeanor under this bill, just like it is if an officer were to write the ticket. And because it's a petty misdemeanor, you have the same due process protections and the same procedures available to appeal this ticket or to challenge it if you feel that you're not the person who the ticket should go to, as you would for any other petty misdemeanor. You have the same procedures available to you as you would if you were handed the ticket by an officer. And by crafting the bill that way, this avoids the legal issues that came up in the past. So that's a brief overview of some of the misunderstandings about the legal issues involved with this. I'd like to quickly give an overview of the technology, and then I'll be happy to try to answer your questions. Oh, I would like to add one more thing about legal issues. There have been comments saying that these could be used to enforce speed limits, and that's not the intention of the bill, and in fact, there's a state law already on the books in Minnesota. It is Minnesota Statute 169.14, Subdivision 10, and that governs the admissibility of a speed measuring device. And that evidence is only admissible in Minnesota courts if the device was operated by an officer. And because these are automated, not operated by an officer, evidence of speed would not be admissible under that statute.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Champion.
Mr. Chair, is it appropriate to ask questions as we go? Because I have a question based on
absolutely.
Something.
Yes.
So to the testifier, you indicated that the bill states somehow that there must be a capturing of the driver and not just the vehicle. If I heard you correctly, could you point me to the place in the legislation that says that?
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Buskey.
Senator, the definition of traffic safety camera, lines 1.5 through 1.7 on the delete all amendment, specifies that it is capable of recording clear images of both vehicle movement at an intersection and the driver of the vehicle.
May
Senator
I follow,
Champion.
Mr. Chair? So so can you tell me where the operator of the cameras will be? Will they be in the state of Minnesota, or will they be someplace else?
Mr. Buskey.
Mr. Chair, Senator, because these are an automated system, there's no real operator of the camera. I can tell you that based on however the system is set up and based on the contract that the municipality negotiates with whichever vendor they choose, what will happen is that the data will be downloaded to a server. Whether that's in the state or in another state depends on the contract that the municipality works out with the vendor. In some cases, there are state laws saying it must be in the state. So, for example, in California, where these systems are, all of the data processing centers must be in that state. Minnesota doesn't have a law currently that governs that, and these vendors have call centers and information centers in various places around the United States. I know, for example, there's one in New Jersey, there's one in Arizona. But in terms of the operator, the data is downloaded automatically, and then it's either reviewed by an officer from the jurisdiction, or in some cases, it's part of the service contract the municipality signs, that the vendor will actually review it first for quality control and then pass it along to the officer.
Senator Champion.
Mr. Chair, I will have some follow-up questions, but maybe I'll let him do the presentation around the technical aspects of the equipment, because they will be around the equipment and some of the other constitutional issues.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Buskey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's a statement of technology that's in your informational packets that kind of explains how the cameras work. I'll give a brief overview of that, but it might be helpful to refer to the statement of technology.
Does that look like? What's this one, members, with the diagrams on it?
I should note that this statement of technology is from Redflex. Redflex is the company that I work for, and that's why I have access to this. However, I will say that it's my understanding that across the industry, the technology works pretty much the same. When they set one of these systems up at an intersection, they set up cameras on each side of the intersection, and that's so, as I covered with Senator Champion, they can take a picture of the face of the driver, And also, they can take a picture of the car from the rear. One of the other things they install is road sensors. And those road sensors are important because they tell this automated system when someone is going to run the red light. And that's important because these systems are only armed when the light is red. These only capture data when the light is red and the system tells it someone's running this light. The way that data works is there's a constant buffering, if you will, a constant stream of data going to the cameras, but it only captures that if there's a red light running incident. If there's not, you get about 6 seconds, and if there's no one that runs the red light in that 6 seconds goes away, and it starts a fresh 6 seconds. So it only captures the data if there's a red light running incident during that time period. And that's a system that's worked out, like I said, using the road sensors.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Champion.
To that point, so to the testifier, can you tell me how the process works in order to identify the driver? Because usually if you have a picture of someone and you don't know who they are, and let's say you indicated earlier that this bill here in the state of Minnesota does not require for the viewer to be here in the state of Minnesota, but they could be someplace else. But you have a picture of someone who purports to be the driver. How do you identify who the driver is? And secondly, what happens if you cannot clearly identify who the driver is?
I'm glad you asked that question,
Mr. Buskey.
I will answer your question. I have a preliminary that I think will help explain it better, if you'll indulge me. When a red light running incident is captured, like I said, that data is either sent to a vendor to review for quality control, and sometimes cities choose to do that to make sure that the vendor checks and says, was there actually a car going through the red light? This wasn't, for example, a squad car with its lights on going through. Or this wasn't, for example, a car that came to a complete stop and then made a lawful right turn on red. In some instances, the city will choose to have the vendor filter those out so the police aren't spending their time reviewing those non-violations. But once that video and pictures are sent to the local police office, because that's who actually issues the ticket, the law enforcement agency responsible for monitoring the program in whatever municipality the systems are put in place in, a law enforcement officer is the one who actually looks at what the system captured, and then the law enforcement officer is the one who has access to the state driving records. Private companies do not have access to Minnesota driver's license records. They do not have access to Minnesota driver's license photos. I apologize, I can't point you to the specific statute that says that, but private entities and out-of-state entities don't have access to that. So it's the local law enforcement officials that'll look at that video and say, all right, the registered owner of this vehicle is X. Let's see what their driver's license photo looks like. Does it match? Yes, it does. The officer will put their electronic signature on the citation, and it'll be sent out by mail. If they pull it up, for example, if the registered owner is a male and the person in the picture is a female, the officer then has discretion to decide how much investigation they want to do to see if they can identify the driver. In some instances, the officer may decide, doesn't match, let's throw it out. And in some cities, they make that choice to process these in that way. In other cities, the officer might do some more investigation. They might say, well, what's the address of the registered owner? And they look at that. Is there another person with a driver's license that address? Yes, this person's husband lives at the same address, and they'll pull up the husband's driver's license photo and say, oh, that's a match. And that's how they conduct that investigation.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Champion.
So what happens, let's say, and I hate to admit this, but my brother probably will be listening sooner or later, but my brother and I, we look pretty much alike, especially now that he got his dreads cut off, okay? And he wears glasses like I do, but our glasses are a little different. He usually violates the law somehow, so I'll put that on him and not put it on me. But let's say someone like him that looks similar to me is driving my car, and we look so much alike that a officer concludes that it's me and not him. So what do you do in that particular scenario? Is the burden then on me as the person who owns the vehicle to now seek to show that I wasn't the driver of the vehicle on that particular day, and now the burden shifts?
Mr. Buskey.
Mr. Chair, Senator, the burden is always on the state to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that you are the person who is issued the ticket. Now, is there a possibility that a citation would be mailed to you in error? Yes. If you look a lot like your brother, if you have a twin brother, that is a possibility. But that's where the due process protections come into play, and that's why they're very important in this bill. You have the same due process protections under Senate File 377 as you would with any other violation. Is it possible that you would have to go to court to appear to challenge the ticket? Yes, it is. But then when you get there, the state has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that it's you in that photo and not your brother. And being a defense attorney, I think you can appreciate that showing a picture of you and your brother looking alike and you're saying, Your Honor, this is my brother, not me, is reasonable doubt. And that's where the due process protections come into play.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Champion.
To the testifier, the challenge that I have with that is simply that the burden and expense now rests upon me to go through a process to try to get a prosecutor or judge to conclude that it wasn't me. So now I have to bring in, because that's what I think I heard you say, that I have to now bring in a photo to show that it's not me. So you're putting the burden back on me.
Mr. Buskey.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I believe that's incorrect. I suggested that one of the things you could do is bring in a photo. However, like I said, the burden is on the state to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that you are the person that was issued that ticket. Is it possible that you might have to appear in court and say it wasn't me if you wished to challenge the ticket? It's possible. Another possibility is that that your brother owns up to running a red light in your car. But the important thing is that the burden never shifts to you to prove anything. You can simply deny that it was you. And if the state can't introduce evidence to prove that it was you, you know, the state's failed to meet their burden. I understand your point, but it's an important distinction that the burden of proof never shifts to the person who receives the ticket. It is always on the state to prove beyond a reasonable doubt.
All right, carry on, Mr. Buskey. Oh, I'm sorry. I had Senator Osnick and then Senator Westrom. I apologize.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Buskey, question regarding motorcycles. I believe, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, I believe under current state statute, motorcycles can go through a red light after waiting an appropriate length of time. Is that correct? Am I misstating that?
Senator Osnick, you are correct.
Okay. I'd like to know, Mr. Chair and Mr. Buskey, I'd like to know how this system is going to allow motorcycles to perform that function after a reasonable length of time without them getting a ticket in the mail, because even if they are, and assuming they're wearing a helmet, it probably is a little bit more difficult to see their faces. Yeah. Let's say that they're not wearing a helmet in this particular case. Can you tell me how that's going to match up with state statute where they can currently run red lights?
Mr. Buskey.
Mr. Chair, Senator, that's a good question. It works the same way as a legal right turn on red would work. If someone enters that intersection after the light has turned red, there is a possibility. In fact, it's likely that the system will trigger and it will take a recording of that. But based on the quality control process going through the local law enforcement reviewing to see if it's a violation, and if the municipality chooses, also another level of review with the vendor, that's the kind of incident that it's intended to filter out to make sure that you don't get that.
Okay, Mr. Chair, Mr.
Senator Osmond.
So the time stamping, I'm looking at the data bar description. Is there going to be time stamping that says, okay, it was at this point of the red light that the snapshot took place? I mean, I'm trying to figure out if a motorcycle goes through a red light, making a, you know, let's say it's a left-hand turn, that is there, you know, is there something that's going to show? Because a motorcycle going through that light, let's say it's going halfway through the red light, there's no traffic coming in either direction. Is there going to be an indicator that says that, or is it just going to be based on a person looking at the data to come up with that evidence?
Trubusky.
Mr. Chair, Senator, there is a piece of the data bar that says how long that light has been red.
All right. Senator Westrom.
Mr. Chair, to the witness, similar to or extending off of Senator Champion's questions, first let me ask, you described there was two cameras. Excuse me. How do you, can you explain again, or maybe I missed it, how do you know that the red light was actually red? Are you just relying on some technology data bar that says it's red, or is that part of one of the pictures with the car and the back license plate?
Senator Westrom.
Mr. Buskey.
The way that the system works is the first picture it'll take will be from the rear of the vehicle before it enters the intersection. And from that shot, you will be able to see that the car has not yet entered the intersection and the light is already red. The second picture it'll take will be showing the car once it has entered the intersection with the light red. The third picture will be a close-up of the driver's face from the front of the intersection, and the fourth picture will be a close-up of the license plate. But with those first two pictures in both of them, you'll be able to see that the light has turned red before the car enters the intersection and that it is red when the car is in the intersection.
Mr. Westrom, or Senator Westrom.
So, Mr. Chair, So to the question Senator Champion talked about, the brother that looks a lot alike, we've got twin daughters. My wife is the only one that can tell them apart, except for me, when I hear them talk. Their teacher can't tell them apart. Their grandmas can't tell them apart. How are your officers going to tell them apart?
Mr. Buskey.
Senator Westrom, it would be very difficult to issue a citation to your daughters correctly. That's the honest answer. It would be very difficult for an officer to tell, looking at their driver's licenses, which was which. And if they couldn't match them up, it's likely no citation would be issued. If a citation was issued in error, or frankly, even if a citation was issued correctly, and one of your twin daughters decided to say, not that they would ever do this, it wasn't me, the state wouldn't be able to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that, in fact, it was whichever daughter was issued the ticket. And in that case, the state would fail to meet their burden, and they couldn't prosecute the petty misdemeanor red light running offense.
So, Senator Mr. Chair, I appreciate your answer on that. I guess the issue then, I mean, the issue that gives me some trouble, though, is we sit here in a committee and presume no wrong citations will be sent. If there's an officer at the intersection that pulls you over, they get to do all that evaluation right there. They get your driver's license. They get to go back and run it, make sure that they've got who they've got. And if that's wrong, I can't think of the situation where they would write you a ticket anyways and you'd end up in front of a judge having to prove that it was your brother or somebody that looked awfully similar to you or some other explanation. We're dealing with technology here. We talked about radar guns earlier, heard that as a comparison of technology. I've had clients that are certain they weren't going as fast as the radar guns said they were going. They ask me to go to court for them, and I ask them, how many thousands of dollars do you want to spend on this speeding ticket? The bottom line answer they get is, it isn't worth fighting. And my concern here is, to Senator Champion's point, if he has to go in, take a half a day off of work, rearrange his schedule, maybe get daycare, go in and hope that he makes his case, and the judge really does believe that this picture of two people was not conclusive enough evidence. But if that judge happens to side with the law, who's got more time on their hands, they get paid to go to court, not Senator Champion to prove his innocence. They get paid to bring in an extra support if they have to. And that judge is persuaded that Senator Champion really was the driver of that car. Now he's not out just that first time to court and all the time and time he's had to do to put evidence together. But if he happened to not get a statement from his brother that said, I was driving the car on that day, and other evidence that would help his case, now all of a sudden he has to go to the appeals court to try to get his decision overturned and prove that the state did not have enough evidence beyond a reasonable doubt. I think that's a problem with your proposal, and I don't know how you get by that.
Mr. Busby.
I guess it's just no question in there. Unless you have a response, I'm happy to listen.
Mr. Busky.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I do have a few brief responses that I think address some of the points you raised. The first point you made about an officer being at the intersection has more opportunity to verify the data. And you're absolutely correct about this. These cameras are not a replacement for a police officer. No piece of technology can replace an officer on the ground at the intersection. But as Mayor Kleiss articulated much better than I can, local governments simply don't have the resources to put an officer at every intersection where red light running is a problem and where it poses a public safety risk. I would submit that these cameras are the next best alternative to an officer. But you're absolutely right that they're no replacement for an officer. As far as your point about the burdens being imposed on someone who's wrongfully issued a ticket, in that instance, while I understand your concerns, I think that goes to Senator Peterson's earlier point about not characterizing the persons who run red lights as the victims. While it is true that there will be citations issued to someone who wasn't the red light runner, it's a fact. It's not 100% perfect. Nothing is. The vast majority, and I can tell you this from the experiences that my client has had operating these systems all over the country, the vast majority of these citations are issued to the person who is the registered owner of the vehicle, and they match up their picture with the registered owner, and it's a very simple matter, the vast majority. So even if you throw out every citation where there's even a question about who the person in the photograph is, whether it's actually that person, and I would submit that under making the state prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the person they're issuing the citation to was in fact the person who ran the red light, those citations should be thrown out. Even with all of those thrown out, these programs can still be successfully run because the vast majority of these tickets, 90-some percent, all go to the people who were in fact running the red light and who are the registered owner of the vehicle. So while I understand the concerns, I don't think that those potential issues outweigh the safety benefit of these cameras.
Senator Westbrook.
Mr. Chair, on that point, then, am I understanding it right? If Senator Champion's niece is borrowing his car and taking a picture, that automatically is going to get thrown out. The basic premise is we start from, do we match the owner of the vehicle with the picture of the camera? And if we don't match that, we're throwing it out from the beginning.
Mr. Busky.
Mr. Chair, Senator Westrum, in many places in the country that are using these programs, that is the default. However, that choice is left up to the local law enforcement agency administering the program. In that instance, the officer reviewing the ticket may decide, you know what, I want to do some more investigation and see if I can figure out who was the person driving. And that's that officer's prerogative. But I can tell you that as a matter of course, in most places, it's not worth the officer's investigative time to do that, and the citations get thrown out if they don't match initially.
All right, Senator Tomasoni.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was intrigued by that six-second reset thing that you talked about. And I know that my personal experience leaving the Capitol and heading up toward the Basilica, there is a intersection there. If you take a left to go down Kellogg Boulevard, where there's a green arrow, and the green arrow is in both directions. It's from the people coming from the Basilica and the people coming from the Capitol. And in rush hour, if you're in that left turn lane, There are as many as three cars from both directions sitting out in the middle of the intersection waiting for cars coming from the other direction. And so when the light turns red, all three of them, three going this way, three going that way, six cars make left turns on the red light. Can the camera take all those pictures?
Mr. Buskin.
Mr. Chair, Senator, no, it can't. The camera will not capture images of anyone who's in the intersection before the light turns red. It will only capture an image if you enter that intersection after it has already turned red.
And then, Mr. Chairman, what if...
And Thompson.
What if three cars run the red light that weren't in the intersection when the light turned red?
Mr. Buskin.
In that instance, Senator, the system would still take the 12-second video clip. There's a good chance that it would not be able to capture clear face shots of all three drivers at the same time if they were going through exactly at the same time. If they're going through, say, 1, 2, 3, the road sensors may be able to detect that and snap those face shots as necessary. But if three cars were to go through at exactly the same time, the system probably would only be able to capture one of those three.
So,
Senator Thompson.
So, Mr. Chairman, this thing might work, it might not, because the only reason I asked those questions is because I saw them happen the other day, and I was thinking about Senator Peterson, and I was, first of all, thinking, boy, Senator Peterson, this is just not a big, I mean, it's not like you to be a big brother person, and then I hear Kleiss is involved, and now I'm going, whoa, is things ever changing around here? And then, now we've got this bill in front of us that has all kinds of questions for me, and I just don't think it's a good idea, and I hope we don't even vote on it, and I hope we just kind of put it on the table, Mr. Chairman, and let it lie there until it dies its own death.
All right. Is that a motion? Senator Kent. Members, actually, we have 35 minutes left. We have a few other folks to hear from, and we are going to have a vote today on this bill.
Just to clarify, because you said something about 12-second video, are these still shots, or is there a video running that still shots are taken from?
Mr. Buskin.
Senator, the answer is both. There are cameras on each side of the intersection, but it's actually three different cameras, and it'll record the video clip from behind as well as take still shots of the face of the license plate separately. So it's a combination.
Good. Thank you.
All right. I have Senator Kiffmeyer, Carlson, Uyghur, Westrum, members, 35 minutes and a few folks to hear from yet. So, and we haven't had the benefit of the full presentation yet. So Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think that this is something that's important to know, because ever since you've been testifying, I'm realizing that you're a company that sells this product. So it's a little bit hard to take this as objective. In addition, I just did a little quick research on your company, and you have kind of an issue in with Mayor Rahm Emanuel in Chicago that happened on February 8th. Maybe you're not aware of that. So while I appreciate your comments and some of the information you give, I just want you to know that I think to us here, those two issues are a concern. And so I appreciate that, and I know that everybody wants to make sure that we get accurate information and as much unbiased as we can in our consideration of an important bill. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You can respond, or I don't know if there's a question. You can respond if you like.
Senator Kiffmeyer, Mr. Chair. To respond briefly, I am aware of the problems in Chicago that you've referred to, and I understand your concerns about getting objective testimony. All I can tell you is that I'm being as truthful with you as I am capable of being, and I am an attorney in Minnesota. I am an officer of the court. I have ethical obligations to be truthful, and I live up to those the best I am able. As far as your question about any problems that the company I do work for has, I think Senator Peterson can probably address that.
Senator Peterson.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm aware of the same thing you brought up, and I did my own research. That's why I know there's nine different companies that any municipality can do, and I would imagine if this bill passes, you can be sure your city councils will do an RFP, a request for proposal, that will certainly bring a competitive bid. I do have a list of the nine companies. Unfortunately, I only have one. I'd be happy to get copies of the nine companies that produce these cameras for the members if they would like.
All right. Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Buska, you mentioned earlier that can't use these for speeding violations, but it says in your technical data here that you do detect the vehicle speed and the posted speed limit for each violation. And then down below it says that you do imprint on the whatever it is, probably the photograph, the speed limit and the speed limit of that location and the vehicle speed. Is that something that all of your customers are accepting? Yeah, I guess I'm wondering why we would put the speed on there.
Mr. Buskey.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, I'm glad you brought that up. My point about these not being able to be used to enforce speed had to do with the Minnesota law limiting the admissibility of speed detection devices in court. Under the existing state law, those have to be operated by an officer, and that was my point about how these could not be used to enforce speed limits. To answer your question about the information contained in the data bar, the way that these systems anticipate whether someone's going to run the red light is by roughly estimating speed based on the use of the road sensors they install. Frankly, those road sensors are not accurate enough to be admissible in a court of law, but they do allow the system to anticipate whether someone's going to enter that intersection when the light is red. So that information is part of the system's calculations, and they're a necessary part to understand whether or not a car is going to enter that intersection when the light is red. But that would not be admissible in court in Minnesota, A, because it's not accurate enough, and B, because we already have a state law saying that only evidence of speed detection devices operated by an officer is admissible in court.
Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In other, and I have the data spread all over the place here, but in other information, you said that there's a delay between the light turning red and the recording of the information starting on. So, I mean, is this anticipation something that is done prior to the light turning red? I would assume that has to be a fact. I would assume if the car is going to be anticipated to go through the red light and the light is not yet red.
Mr. Buskey.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I believe that this only happens once the light is actually red, and the way that it can operate that way is that the first road sensor is usually installed maybe 15, 20 feet back from the intersection. So if it goes over that road sensor and it detects a speed that says this vehicle won't be able to stop in time, it can still capture the vehicle before it enters the intersection. However, the system itself is not armed and cannot be triggered to capture data unless the light is already red.
And Mr. Chair,
Senator
Mr. Kruska, how many of these systems does your company have installed?
Mr. Buskey.
That is a question I do not know the answer to. I could give you a rough estimate, which would a few hundred throughout the country.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Mr. Buskey, what's the nature of the compensation system that you most often have with the users of this?
Mr. Buskey.
Mr. Chair, Senator, the most frequently used compensation system is a flat fee per intersection per month, say at X amount of dollars each month for each intersection where this system is installed at. And I can tell you that that is the system that was in place when Minneapolis had a program back in 2005, 2006. The city paid a flat fee per month per intersection.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Mr. Buskey, you mentioned that officers would be reviewing the files before giving them. I'm sorry, you mentioned that the first filter would be the company, presumably, and then it would be turned over to an officer to look at the data that the state has. Now, is that across the board? Do you have access to any other state's driver's license files and photos?
Mr. Buskey.
Mr. Chair, Senator, as far as I know, we don't have access to any driver's license photos in any state in the country. I think they all have state laws limiting that access. And so we don't do that facial comparison for any of our clients.
And one more.
Senator Carlson.
Assuming you know what your competitors do, do any of your competitors have access to data, to driver's license data?
Mr. Obusky.
Senator, to the best of my knowledge, no, they don't. The same state laws that apply to us apply to our competitors.
Thank you.
All right, members. Again, I will draw your attention to the time. 25 minutes left. We have Senator Westrum and Senator Wieger.
Go ahead. Mr. Chair, I'm just looking through the amendment, and maybe while this witness is up there, I think it's applicable, but maybe Senator Peterson. As I'm reading the amendment, it doesn't actually say the picture. It has to be a picture of the intersection as I read it, but not the red light. Is that an oversight, or is that just clearly presumed that the red light has got to be part of the picture in the intersection and the vehicle, or do we need to be a little more explicit on that if this was to pass and move on?
Mr. Buskey or Senator Peterson.
Mr. Chair, Senator, these photographs and this evidence wouldn't be of any use unless it included the red light. So while that is not part of the explicit language, it's something we thought went unsaid, although a clarification would be welcome if you felt it was necessary. We wouldn't object to that in any way.
All right. Senator Wieger.
Mr. Chair, in recognition of the time and remaining witnesses, I'll wait.
All right. Thank you. So Senator Champion and Senator Sendrum.
Just a brief question to the testifier. I'm looking at one point from the amendment, 1.26 that says operating traffic safety cameras to detect violations of traffic regulations, and there's an S at the end of regulations. So my question is, even though you testified earlier that there could not be any monitoring of speeding, but does this also open up the opportunity for, let's say, law enforcement or other people to look at the picture, try to figure out who it is on the picture, and then maybe run a scan of their license to see if they're driving after suspension or after revocation or anything of that nature?
Mr. Buskey or Senator Pierce?
Senator Champion, that was not the intent. I would defer to our legal expert, Ms. Berezovsky, but certainly if necessary, that's some language that we could tighten up to address that concern.
Did you catch the question, Ms. Berezovsky?
Mr. Chair and Senator Champion, we could insert by amendment, or you could insert by amendment, if you wish, a reference to the, I guess it would be 169.06, a violation of 169.06, and then that would specifically narrow it to traffic signal violations.
Question for our counsel.
Senator Champion.
If I decided not to make that oral amendment or put that amendment on the table, as the language sits right now, would there be the possibility of this being expanded beyond just someone running a red light, but possibly an infraction around driving after suspension or revocation if you have to do comparisons of pictures and figure out if the person was driving on that day?
Ms. Berezovsky.
Based on the language?
Mr. Chair and Senator Champion, I'm not sure if the language is really allows me to give you a clear answer because it does. I'm just looking at this. No, I guess I think that it would open up that possibility in terms of, because this just authorizes or enables the local jurisdiction to adopt a program. The local jurisdiction would have to interpret that language, and ultimately, if a person, you know, was charged with a violation, wanted to challenge it, the court would then be the ultimate determiner of whether this language authorizes that. But I would say that this language does not prohibit a local jurisdiction from using the camera for purposes other than red light violations.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Peterson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and members, I should note that Senator Latz in the Senate Judiciary Committee has also asked to see this bill, and so that would be our intent to offer a motion to move this bill to Judiciary. where certainly there is a significant amount of expertise in that committee as well, relating to some of the legal aspects of this bill. So that may give some members some assurance and confidence that that the bill certainly will be reviewed again. And as far as that amendment goes, I would be happy to work with Senator Champion between now and then if that would be the desire. So.
All right. Thank you. Senator Senchum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think Senator Champion got to my question as well, and it would seem as though everything from seat belts to whether you signaled or not, or headlights or expired license or anything else might be fair game, at least under this language. So I think my question's answered.
All right, thank you. So, Mr. Buskey, were you done with your presentation?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, thank
you. All right, Senator Peterson. We have more people who want to testify. We need members. We need to do that quickly. 20 minutes, and we're going to vote on this bill before we adjourn at 5:30. We're not going to go long.
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure who else is.
We have Ann Finn.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Ann Finn. I represent the League of Minnesota Cities. I want to thank Senator Peterson for carrying Senate File 377. I know this is a difficult issue, and I appreciate all the good questions and the deliberate nature that you're approaching this with. I'll try to be brief. I have 3 points I wanted to leave with you today. First, and this is something you've heard already, but property taxpayers cannot afford to have a police officer stationed at every dangerous intersection, nor can they afford to rebuild every intersection that is antiquated or prone to collisions. The cameras hold red light runners accountable at a minimal cost to taxpayers. The way the bill is drafted, it also preserves the officer discretion that most people, including our city officials, believe should remain intact. The second point, I've heard opponents of this legislation describe city support for the initiative as revenue-driven. I can tell you that the city officials who worked on the league's policy position never once mentioned or listed revenue generation as a reason to support photo enforcement. They were motivated by a desire to enhance public safety. In fact, cities do not profit when officers issue any tickets. On average, a violator pays between $115 and $127 for a petty misdemeanor traffic offense. Of this amount, the state receives $75 in the form of a surcharge. Under the statutory formula, the city receives between $13 and $20 per ticket. This is hardly an incentive to enforce violations. And finally, are these cameras unpopular? Yes, they probably are. And traffic tickets are unpopular too, but they do change driving habits of some individuals. People know that some intersections are monitored. They're more attentive and less likely to err on the side of proceeding through a red light. I will stop there, and again, I thank you for allowing us to testify today. I'll take any questions.
Senator Westrom. Oh, I thought you were on the list. All right.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Sender.
Well, maybe to my last question or at least comment, the city support this use for well beyond just the traffic light, signals, speed, et cetera, the full menu of potential traffic violations which might occur?
Mr. Chair and Senator Senjum, we've not had that conversation. The policy position that we have speaks only to the red light enforcement, and that's where we've had the concern by our city officials.
Okay, thank you.
All right, Senator Peterson, we also have Dorian Grilly. Yeah.
Mr. Chair, I mean, I would be willing to offer an oral amendment to address Senator Champion and Senator Senjum's concern. Ms. Berezovsky gave us that statute number. It was 169 Plano 6, subdivision 4, if I wrote that down correctly. So on line 1.25 of the A1 amendment, we would insert operating. It would be 0.69 Plano 6, subdivision 4, right after the colon, and then it would read "and operating traffic safety cameras." Is that correct, Mrs. Berezovsky, or should it go at the end of that sentence?
Ms. Berezovsky is out of the room helping someone else with an amendment.
I have.
Senator Champion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think our Senate counsel was suggesting perhaps that the amendment would be on line 1.26, deleting traffic regulations and inserting Minnesota Statute Section 169.06.
And we don't need to include subdivision 4?
That's not what I see here. And she's right there.
Berezovsky is here. So we'll catch you up quickly, Ms. Berezovsky. So what we're considering was an oral amendment from Senator Peterson to strike traffic regulations, so it would read violations of 169.06. And the question is, do we need to include subdivision 4?
Mr. Chair, I would say it's a matter of judgment. Subdivision 4 relates only to obedience to traffic control signal or flagger. But there are, for example, Subdivision 7 refers to a flashing red signal, obedience to a flashing red signal, Subdivision 8 to lane direction control signal, and Subdivision 9 deals with the motorcycle question if they're crossing against a light because they didn't trip the red light. So it depends if you want to narrow it just to the basic red light running or add those other elements.
Senator Peterson, what's your pleasure?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members, I think that was the intent of some of the members on the committee to make it as specific as possible, and so I would encourage us to include subdivision 4.
Okay. So, members, the sentence would read, operating traffic safety cameras to detect violations of section 169.06 subdivision 4. Any questions? All in favor of that, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion passes. All right, where are we? Moving on. Oh, Mr. Grilley, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the Bicycle Alliance of Minnesota supports the use of traffic safety cameras for enforcement of Minnesota Statute 169.06 Subdivision 4. Traffic safety concerns are the number one deterrent to more people bicycling more often. Most bicycle motor vehicle collisions occur at intersections, and we believe traffic safety cameras would have a strong deterrent effect, as has been mentioned before, which would reduce crashes at intersections and save lives. You've heard plenty of testimony. I'll give you a little personal story. 2 years ago, I was in a crosswalk and was struck by a car that the driver, I believe, had every intent of turning right on red without stopping at that intersection. The driver was pled guilty to careless driving, was fined $500. I spent 3 weeks in Regents Hospital, and it cost $350,000 to screw me back together. So I personally am in support of this, and the Bicycle Alliance has supported this. I believe it'll add some civility to driving on our roads.
We're glad you're sitting before us today, Mr. Grilley.
Yeah, thank you.
None the worse for the wear. Senator Sendrum.
I got to ask this question. I would say in Rochester, Minnesota, far more bicycles go through red lights than cars. Should we apply this to bicycles as well?
If Mr. Chairman, Senator Sendrum.
Hearing, Mr. Grilley, yeah.
If it was technologically possible, the Bicycle Alliance would support that. We teach bike education classes, and our motto in those classes are bicyclists fare best when they act and are treated like the drivers of vehicles. So our message immediately at the beginning of every class is you need to obey the rules of the road. You are a road user, and we're on the same campaign as you.
research.
And I will attest the Minnesota Bicycle Alliance, Minneapolis Bicycle Coalition are working very, very hard to ingrain that culture of responsible biking behavior.
Mr. Chair, absolutely. Is that true in Minneapolis as well?
Yep. I just said the Minneapolis Bicycle Coalition as well.
No, I mean, do Minneapolis bicyclists go through traffic lights?
Some do, yeah. It's pretty bad. I'm a bicyclist, Senator Senjum, and when I'm driving and bicyclists behave in a bad manner, I'm probably the angriest one when I'm driving and bicycles are zipping around me. But we'll have that discussion again soon, I'm sure. Moving on, we have a couple of more testifiers. We'll try to get through them. Why don't I have you both come forward? Dennis Flaherty from MPPOA and Rich Neumeister.
Good afternoon, members. For the record, my name is Dennis Flaherty, and I'm Executive Director of the Minnesota Police and Peace Officers Association. And I'm here today to oppose Senate File 377. Across our country, municipalities are attracted to the use of cameras in traffic law enforcement, largely due to the promise of reduced crashes and increased revenue from the issuance of citations. While the results of these studies often show some reduction in angle crashes, they also show an increase in rear-end crashes at these very same intersections. Much of the research that has been conducted has been funded by the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety, which is owned by auto insurance companies. These programs create more ill will, and I guess this is what disturbs most of my members, toward police than almost any other single enforcement effort that they might be involved with. The ill will is not toward city officials that rally for the use of cameras, but instead at the police, because it's the police mailing the ticket to them. Revenue-driven enforcement is detested by the public. They also see a huge conflict of interest when they find out that private companies are paid a commission from the tickets that are issued. In San Diego in 2009, a court threw out the use of camera enforcement, citing lack of oversight and the method of compensation made evidence from cameras, and I quote, so untrustworthy and unreliable that it should not be admitted. In 2011, Arizona decided not to renew their contract with the camera vendor following a study of their 76 statewide photo enforcement areas, citing, quote, less than expected revenues, mixed public acceptance, and mixed data. Also in June 11, Edmonton, Alberta, canceled all 100,000 tickets issued by their photocop program due to concerns over reliability. Currently in Iowa, there's a bill that recently has won House approval that would take revenue generated from local enforcement efforts of photocop enforcement and transfer it to the state's road use tax fund. The bill would allow cities to keep a portion of the collections necessary to pay off the private vendor, but not to profit from them. Their governor said that he would sign the bill if it is sent to them. Obviously, the cities are strongly opposing this measure. The author, the legislator, just simply hopes this offsets the public resentment there is towards these cameras. Nothing can substitute having direct contact with an officer to correct driving behavior. Whether that means they issue them a ticket, a written warning, or just a strong verbal warning, there's no substitution for that. Plus, only an officer stopping a car can arrest motorists that are impaired, have no license, no automobile insurance, or might even have outstanding warrants. Cameras cannot replace that value to the community. Instead, we're going to go to a system where someone's going to find out who the registered owner is of the vehicle, run the driver's license of that registered owner, and if the camera photo is even close to that on the driver's license of the registered owner, a citation will be sent to the owner at the address on their license. If it's a correct address, we'll assume the citation is received. If it isn't, we'll assume that it will be returned. This is an important element because tickets not paid can and do turn into license suspensions. So someone issued a ticket through a photocop program could easily find themselves later arrested and even their cars impounded, when they never realized they were even cited in the first place. When an officer hands you a citation and you fail to take action, then you become responsible for whatever action develops. This is an evidentiary nightmare that you would allow to take place here. And it's not just, it would not be just in isolated cases. It would, it is a problem. It's a problem wherever these cameras are used. And I don't know that this is really the way the state of Minnesota would want to go. I don't think this is popular as the advocates would have you leave or have you believe. But the promise of profits from the motoring public should not be considered. Traffic enforcement must be left to the discretion of police officers. And interestingly, I just learned a couple days ago that the State Patrol, our State Patrol, in concert with our DOT, is just about ready to launch their own camera program. We've spent $300,000 of taxpayer money to fund it up to this point. St. Cloud is meant to be, and they know that they're meant to be, one of the pilots for this program. And what it would do is it employs the same technology. The only difference is an officer is sitting downstream from this intersection. He or she sees the red light violation, stops the car, stops the motorist, can even bring the motorist back to the squad car and show the motorist what they just did, freezes it. It's used for evidentiary purposes in court. And I don't understand. We're doing this internally in our state, but yet the bill before you would turn it over to private vendors. And lastly, in the spirit of being brief, we were told in the House hearing that this was only to be used for intersections. You correctly found the one flaw in the amendment. And on the backside of it, new language on 1.26 says, operating traffic safety cameras to detect violations of traffic regulations. So I don't know if that's a drafting error or whether they...
Mr. Clarity, we amended that.
That one is the one you amended?
We just
did you amend
it.
The one on the front side then, which is pretty much the same? A violation of a traffic regulation ordinance is detected through the use of camera... Or no, not that one.
We amended 1.26.
Okay. All right. Okay.
Thank you.
So that essentially...
Clarity, we need to wrap up. We have amendments to deal with in three minutes left in this committee hearing.
I appreciate that.
Thank you.
I've been sitting diligently here waiting to get up.
I acknowledge that. I apologize.
I just want to just simply say that I would hope that this is not the route you would select for the state of Minnesota. Motoring public deserves better.
Thank you. Mr. Neumeister.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister. And for those people who may not know me, who are new, I've been around for a long time on privacy and open government type issues. This type of bill has been kicking around before the Senate and the House since 2001. It's gone down every time because of a great number of issues, and it's controversial. And it surrounds basically about three concepts, three principles that you need to get into. One is the whole issue of privacy and liberty. Do we want to set up for the first time where we have it like an automatic law enforcement, which the strong history of this state on a bipartisan aspect is no. We don't want to use technology unless we know what it is. Number two, comes into the issue of the equality of enforcement. And then the big kicker is the revenue. So those are the three broad aspects. Now, it seems like I don't have time to get into some of the other aspects because you got five and basically 1 minute to do the bill. But let's focus at least on some of the things because I believe good information brings out good legislation. It's important for both sides to have that good legislation. Number one, like they just give out some handouts, and you've seen with a lot of the proponents have talked about in regards to the studies. I just want to talk about those studies. In your packets, you have a Wall Street Journal article that just came out that talks about it's all over the board. That's one of the reasons why you see so diverse laws as it relates to traffic safety cameras.
Yep, yep.
Right now, in the last year, you have had Houston, Los Angeles, Chicago, Florida, Connecticut. Either like Houston, Chicago, or Houston, San Diego, and Florida, they've either recently have taken off red lights or safety cameras off the deal. They're no longer using them, or there's legislation in there to take them away. I mean, this is not something. I mean, you get a lot into constitutional rights, and I think it's important for this committee to take a look at the revenue stream that may or may not happen. There was $2.6 million in almost the year that the city of Minneapolis had these. $2.6 million was refunded.
A couple more.
The state, in Washington, D.C., in the last fiscal year, $85 million with the use of their speed and red light cameras. Chicago, which has been in the news lately about some issues about red light cameras and the company, one of the companies that involve themselves with it, $69 million. So, Mr. Chairman, I don't know if I'll have an opportunity to get into the details because of the time, but even if you look at the one bill here, I'm glad that it was recognized about the speed, because speed cameras, license plate reader cameras, could be used for enforcement purposes, which, Mr. Chairman, as you know, you're very familiar with that issue, license plate readers, cameras. Now, on Section 3 of the amendment, it basically makes secret citations. So now we're going to have tickets that are going to be sent out about the, you know, where the public has a very much a right to know. They're going to be secret. Those are some issues that I come into play. What I handed out to you was basically two things. One was a copy of the NCSL. If you go to the NCSL website, it does a good bipartisan kind of approach to this issue. Those are the states, as of 2011, are dealing a lot with this issue. Number two, I share with you just a comment from George Orwell. And I think it comes down to the main point. And I think it's important to think about it, because this is not just, let's pass photocop, let's do some things, whatever. It's basically you're making a change of culture here in Minnesota. And now, Mr. Chairman, if the bill progresses, and you have to decide whether or not, if the bill progresses, if some of the things that I'm going to mention are important for your committee. These were our possible amendments. Should it be a civil penalty? Should any citation based on red light cameras that is not in compliance with the installation maintenance be dismissed? Should the notification of the ticket, rather than 21 days, should it be shorter? Should there be a differentiation between where someone at 2 o'clock in the morning is going that quarter of a mile an hour, the red light, they really stopped, but they really didn't, but they still get caught? Many states have different variations of this kind of thing. Also, the whole issue of annual reports. Accountability, I think, is one of these things. I suggest a sunset. You know, see how much money it gets. A cap of how many cameras a local authority may be based, which could be based on size. Because, like, for example, in Dallas, where they put it on, they collected $2.5 million alone. I already know of some places, like, where folks in Minneapolis-St. Paul can do these kinds of things. I think there needs to be a whole issue about the role of vendors. Should this be shared with the insurance companies? Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, there are other perspectives in detail that I have, because I've been studying and dealing with this issue for a number of years.
Thank you, Mr. Neumeister. Senator Miller, obviously, members, we have chosen to go longer. It's the prerogative of the committee. We're not done with the bill. Everyone had a lot of questions. Can you have questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So we're going to stay here until we're done with this bill.
I have a quick question,
Senator Miller.
For actually Mr. Flaherty.
Thank you, Mr.
Flaherty. You mentioned something about there's some trials going on in different cities with police officers. Can you just do that real quick, where they take a picture and then they pull somebody over and they show the the photo. Can you just, that just sparked my interest.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Miller, no, that, what I was talking about is the technology that our state that has been working on this based on a $300,000 grant from the Department of Transportation that would allow the use of cameras at intersections. The only difference is, I think it's the same basically technology, except there will be an officer that will be viewing the camera, will stop the motorist, will issue the citation, and it can actually show the motorist, can replay the violation by having the motorist step up to the car. And then, of course, that same tape, that photo, would be used for purposes. So it takes all this private vendor out of it. It takes it inserts the officer actually presenting it, so there's no evidentiary issues. And St. Cloud is, in fact, going to be, if not the pilot site, it's going to be one of the pilot cities that has been selected. The St. Cloud Police Department has been working on that with the State Patrol. So I only just said, why are we going to a private vendor when it sounds like in the very near future we're going to be having our own enforcement efforts without having to, where there won't be any questions about did the ticket arrive in the mail or didn't it? Does it look like the driver or is it in fact the driver? Those are that's the whole problem behind the photocop that's being promoted here. There are enforcement and evidentiary nightmares.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Senator Champion.
Mr. Chair, I just would like to request a roll call.
All right. Roll call has been requested. Roll call will be granted. Members, I know we have amendments. Let's entertain those now. Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm concerned about this because I want to vote for it, but because my cities have said that they would like to have it, and my police chief has said that is it a lot different than the security cameras at Walmart and the security yes. cameras that are in the police, squad cars, and maybe even those that are not related to to an infraction when they're just. Used in evidence, and I guess I have to say that that's we're under camera right now, and so that is something that we're going to have to live with. But I'm concerned about the profit motive that might tend to drive the use of this. I'm concerned about the method of compensating an outside vendor. I'm concerned about providing an outside vendor the access to our motor vehicle information. I'm concerned about having outside vendors perform the first filter or even the final filter before a person is charged. And then also concerned with the ill will that's developed by having these kinds of big brother types of oversights of our traffic. But I also am concerned about people that are getting hurt and killed on intersections too, and I have a sister that got T-boned in a situation like this, and so I really do want to figure out a way to make this work. And so, Mr. Chair, I have the A4 amendment.
Senator Carlson offers the A4.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The A4 amendment, and hopefully we have some copies coming out here. And this primarily takes care of some of my concerns, the first one being the contract with a private entity and that the compensation is not related to the number of citations that are given out. So it takes away that tendency for the private company to make a lot of money by issuing more citations. And the second one is the access to private data, to the state's driver's license information. And that what this does, in my view, is it forces the oversight of this and the actual viewing of driver's license information and the file that's created when there's a violation in making that determination that this is the person that should be done within the police department. And even then, what we can do is people can be cut a little bit of slack if it's 2:30 at night and maybe there's no traffic and hasn't been anyone at that intersection. So, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the A4 amendment.
Thank you, Senator Carlson. Members have the A4. Senator Peterson.
Yeah. Mr. Chair and members, I'm interested in earning Senator Carlson's support for this bill, so I would encourage you to support the amendment.
All right. Very good. Questions, comments, members? All in favor of the A4 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no?
No.
No.
Motion passes. All right. All right, division has been requested. Everyone in favor, please raise your hands. The A4. Everyone opposed, please raise your hands. On a vote of 8-6, the motion passes. All right. Any other amendments, members?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
One of the concerns I have in regards to this particular bill, there are several issues here, but while I've tried to formulate an amendment, the time has been too short. And so as a result, I can't support the bill in its current language. And maybe in the future, possibly, or something like that. But I think many of the concerns that have been brought forward here are still unaddressed, even with the addition of this amendment. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Senator Wieger.
Yes, Mr. Chair, a lot of the discussion has been on whether a municipality would want to voluntarily implement this. It's my understanding that counties could also do this through the sheriff's department. Would that be correct?
I don't know. Ms. Berzofsky, do you know the answer to that question?
Mr. Chair and Senator Wieger, counties would be authorized to adopt a program with that would affect roads, streets, and highways under their jurisdiction, county roads.
So, and Mr. Chair, and I think that could well happen. Another unit of government is state, and even though we refer to local, it's a unit of government. And what if we looked at, you know, we have hundreds of cameras through MnDOT now, not that they are on deck for being used for this, but potentially if the commissioner approved, I saw a potential application of this statewide as well, and maybe Ms. Berzofsky could tell me whether this is a potential scenario.
Senator Wieger, Ms. Berzofsky.
Mr. Chair and Senator Wieger, the Section 2 in the bill just deals with authorizing local jurisdictions. It's all about the issue of uniformity. Because there is an overriding law that says the traffic laws have to be uniform across the state, this section of statute provides exceptions where we authorize local units to regulate traffic in certain ways. So this shouldn't change. If the state has the authority to do it now, this doesn't change it. If it lacks the authority, this bill does not grant them the authority.
Okay, Senator Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm also in the same situation, I think, as Senator Carlson. By far, some of my biggest cities that I represent are supportive of it. But I do have the concerns that Senator Champion mentioned earlier, in case he has a brother who looks like him. And what can we do if you are put in the position where you would have to essentially defend yourself, take the time, and go contest a violation? And I'm not sure we have time for another amendment, but I'm just thinking out loud and see if you would consider some language to have sort of a safe harbor restitution in place if an event that a city and issues a fine and it turns out to be erroneous and it's proven that the person who is made whole for their time and expense. I just think there is certain burden for someone to have to take the time to contest a ticket.
Sure, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members, you know, I would be more than willing to work with Senator Franson on that issue, and I can give you my word that we would not request a hearing in Judiciary until we had met your concerns in the bill. Is that satisfactory?
Senator Franson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Peterson, and that would satisfy my concern, and I think we have more attorneys here than we have in the judiciary, so we're definitely going to look at that language, and I'd like to have Senator Champion's input on that.
Thank you.
All right. Senator Osmek.
Mr. Chair, just briefly, what I just heard I think sort of flies in somewhat in the face of existing law, and that what we're – if I have a speeding ticket and I'd contest it, do I have mechanisms? Perhaps this is a question for legal counsel. Do I have mechanisms by which I can get my attorney's fees paid for and all these other fees and all the expenses that I have paid for because I wasn't supposed to get a speeding ticket or any other violation of state law? I'm getting very nervous here that what was just said here is creating a brand new, if we did it wrong, we give you money back scenario, which would be incredibly a bad maneuver on this committee's part.
All right, Senator Wigger.
Mr. Chair, I agree. Senator Osmek, I had a constituent in for 30, 40 minutes today just talking about, not on this bill, but the same concept of where he had to take a lot of time off from work to defend what was a mistake. He wasn't asking for restitution, but if we're going to entertain that type of amendment, that does, I would understand that, but it opens the floodgate.
And, Mr. Chair, one further comment. Would that not require a fiscal note on this because we would be sending money back to individuals to reimburse them? Would that not create a fiscal note on this bill?
The proposed Franzen Amendment?
Yes. Requiring it to come back here again.
Had fun today. This has been great. Ms. Wazowski wanted to respond.
Mr. Chair and Senator Osmek, it would depend how it was structured. If it was the state that was going to reimburse the wrongly accused violators or non-violators, but if it's the jurisdiction that is collecting the fines, it wouldn't be a fiscal note to the state.
All right. Any other comments or amendments, members? Senator Peterson, do you have a motion?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members, I'd move Senate File 377 as amended and recommended to pass and sent to the Judiciary Committee for second review.
Thank you, Senator Peterson. Roll call has been requested. Roll call granted. Clerk will take the roll.
Chairman Dibble.
Yes.
Senator Carlson.
Yes.
Senator Champion.
No.
Senator Franson.
Yes.
Senator Jensen.
Yes.
Senator Kent.
No.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
No.
Senator Miller.
No.
Senator Osmek.
No.
Senator Peterson.
Yes.
Senator Pratt. Senator Reinert.
No.
Senator Rest.
Yes.
Senator Senjum.
No.
Senator Tomasoni.
No.
Senator Westrum, Senator Wigger.
No.
In the vote of 6-9, the motion does not pass. Senator Peterson.
Mr. Chair, I'd make a motion to move Senate File 377 as amended without recommendation from this committee to Judiciary.
Mr. Chairman, the bill's dead, isn't it? You just defeated the bill.
It's never dead.
Well, we can take an alternative motion, Senator Tomasoni. Senator Champion.
I request another roll call.
Okay. On the motion to move the bill as amended without recommendation to Judiciary, the clerk will take the roll.
Chairman Dibble.
Yes.
Senator Carlson.
Yes.
Senator Champion.
No.
Senator Franson.
Yes.
Senator Jensen.
Yes.
Senator Kent.
No.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
No.
Senator Miller.
No.
Senator Osmick.
No.
Senator Peterson.
Yes.
Senator Pratt. Senator Reinert.
No.
Senator Rest.
Yes.
Senator Senjum.
No.
Senator Tomasoni.
No.
Senator Westrum. Senator Uyghur.
Yes.
On a vote of 7-8, the motion does not pass. Thank you, members.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And with that, members, we are adjourned.